resume the hearing.
Can I just go back to that question about urban environments and the implications of a zone that comes under that heading in the
Index
to the plan? And because Mr. Giddens has just pointed out that it can't be determinative, the fact that a zone appears under that heading can't be determinative of whether it's urban development and should be within a UGB, because it includes settlement zones, which aren't either of those things. Well, I mean, there might be, it's rural residential environments, really, small settlements, but they're not within a UGB, so that's the simple answer. It's not just your index the chapters and the structure of the plan isn't determinative of the issue.
I think you find that strategic chapters treat the settlement zone, settlement with a capital S, as an urban zone.
Yeah, well, that's my point.
But
they're not within a UGB, though, on the plan.
That's right, and there's a specific set of rules around the policies say urban development. I'm paraphrasing from recollection, shall be within UGBs, or for those settlements without a UGB, within the settlement, within the zone settlement. So I think that, I'm not sure that that's a complete answer to the point, but I understand the previous answer you gave me, which is that it's my colleagues will cringe, but it's the duck principle. If it looks like a duck, it is a duck.
Yeah, and I would, I don't want to get too far off track, but then I would also just say that if it's got to be an assessment of a duck on the ground, including, you've got to get the whole picture in this case. And to get the character of the zone and not just the development in a contextual vacuum. And I would say that if you're looking at GFA traffic generation, there may not be too much difference in the appearance, and it might not be obvious what each zone is if you compared it to a rural industrial zone, for example, which allows big plant, equally high traffic generating activities, and looking at it on the ground in its developed state in this location, it might look the same.
How do you balance that comment with the second sentence in the definition of urban development that says it may be characterised by ... its cumulative generation of traffic? That seems to suggest that traffic generation could be what is used to determine something as urban rather than the colour of the building.
Yes, well, it may be, but you've got to take the definition. You can't just pick out bits of that definition and say that determines the ultimate characteristics of the zone. It's one of the things you have to consider.
Do you think the definition is an exclusive set of considerations that can be taken into account? So have a look through, or do you think it's sufficiently open-ended that on a case-by-case basis other things, I don't know what they might
mean. No, well, it says means, and so that's the definition.
Yeah.
I haven't done
this. Again, that second sentence where it says may be characterised.
Which it says, which is not of a rural character and is differentiated from, you have to read the whole thing.
Yeah, I agree with you.
And it may be characterised, it says urban development may also be characterised by.
No, that's fine. The question is, we've got the items in the first sentence, which is scale, intensity, visual character, dominance of the structures. And then we've got the second sentence, which is a maybe, not necessarily must be, which is reticulated services and traffic. So the question is that it in terms of coming to a view on whether something is urban or not? Or do you think the definition allows for anything else to be taken?
Well, that's clearly not the end of it. I think you have to read. Not that it's relevant here. That is the definition.
Yeah.
You can't go beyond that.
That's actually my sense too.
Well, it is. I am reporting to you the outcome of the assessment that Mr. Milne took, based on that definition. So I think if you want to, I can't take it any further than that. I guess the other point is that we haven't withdrawn our request for an urban growth boundary if you think that there are plan integrity issues if it's not included within a UGB.
I think to my mind it speaks to the process within which one would consider a request for a new zone in light of that Section 3 and 4 framework. Whether it is urban or not, does then ask a series of questions about the process of growth boundaries. So I'm not convinced how determinative it is, but to me it's more figuring out which pathway we would need to follow to assess the request. But I do think it's one of the first things we'd need to reach a view on is it urban or not? Given the plan has a whole bunch of policies talking about how you deal with urban development outside of the new UGB.
That's fine, and that's something that you can explore further with the planner and with Tony Milne on landscape, and I think we've got both bases covered, depending on the outcome of or what your answer to that question is.
Looking at reverse sensitivity issues, the quoting the Christchurch IHP decision at your page 12.
Yes.
Was the judge making a comment on the legal question as to whether it was appropriate to manage reverse sensitivity or whether on the facts there was sufficient evidence that reverse sensitivity issues arose? Or both?
I think it's first. There's no discussion there. Well, I mean, I stand to be corrected by Ms. Lawson. All legal questions arise in a factual context, and so the question of whether restrictions are justified in the circumstances of the case necessarily is in a particular factual context, and it arises here in a different factual context. But the same matters of principle, legal principle, arise. Put us into proportion, the restrictions have got to be justified, and that involves a consideration of what are the, what is the sensitivity of the newcomer to the adverse effects of the incumbent activity. And how do we reconcile those? And I think that's the important thing.
I think the last sentence of that paragraph is quite important.
So which is the last sentence? Is this the paragraph that I've cited?
Yeah. Yes.
Expect such a principle, if intended, to be clearly expressed, given the constraints.
Would impose,
on the capacity for plans to instigate and assist land use change for greater community well-being. I mean, in some cases, you can't keep away from... You can't always... prevent reverse sensitivity effects, because in some circumstances it may be appropriate to bring more sensitive uses closer to a long-standing existing use.
I read that last sentence as just emphasising that reverse sensitivity is not it's a category of effect, but it's restricting new activities on the grounds of reverse sensitivity is not enshrined in the Act. And that is the point that I'm making.
Yeah.
And that's as far as I can take it. And it's and I think it's just a bit of ground truthing, really, before you get too carried away with the notion that reverse sensitivity effects are a valid ground for restraining activities on an adjoining site. Let's just take a look at, we've got to balance the competing rights of the landowners, the need to give that a level of protection, but also the need to recognise the rights of the development rights of the adjoining landowner, and how can they be reconciled?
The question I was going to next was, understand the point of principle the judge was referring to that you're emphasising, but is that balance now skewed by the RPS, which does enshrine reverse sensitivity for regionally significant infrastructure?
This isn't regionally significant infrastructure. It might, if that was the case here, but it's not defined so as to include this activity. Regionally significant infrastructure would include airports and ports and some other activities as well, but
yep.
It doesn't include this landfill. And then even then, it doesn't completely skew it because, as you will appreciate, you still have to look at the degree to which sensitive activities, constraints are justified. And, you know, there's a balance to be struck. Whether there should also be some restrictions on the nuisance-causing activity. They're not given free licence to generate adverse effects, even if they are given that degree of protection under the RPS.
Now, going to the NPSUD, your discussion of that, paragraph 81, you talked to us about policy one. Policy one has a number of characteristics that at a minimum will contribute to well-functioning urban environments. At a minimum suggests that there are other characteristics. The question that's been raised in other contexts is, should we have regard to Objective 8, which relates to greenhouse gas considerations, climate change considerations, when deciding what is a well-functioning urban environment?
Yes, definitely. And I think that doesn't militate against... It doesn't militate against this rezoning proposal for the reason that, as Mr. Giddens notes in his evidence, this would avoid the need for the need for further industrial land to be met by the supply in Cromwell or Wanaka, which is further away and which does involve more travel, and which is obviously, in terms of that first policy, less accessible and probably less affordable as well.
Thank you. And paragraph 82, you're referring to policy 8, local authority decisions are responsive. What do you think responsive means in that context?
It's not all up to them. Responsive. There's also an equivalent provision which requires the council to engage with landowners. Sometimes landowners and developers on the ground at the coalface know best in terms of where the demand is and what the best use of land is. And it's not a case where it's the council as master planner, leave it to us, we know best. And so it's really just being responsive to the development community and engage with them.
Thank you. Any additional questions?
Yes, just one. Thanks, Stephen.
if we were to, no, I'll start again. I can see a pathway to granting the relief were we to agree with either or the scenarios you've put to us. But I just want to test with you, if we were to find that the proposal was sufficiently more urban than rural, that we found it was urban development, and we found that there were tensions with the urban growth boundary language used, particularly in Chapter 4 of the plan, one option is you just slap a UGB around it. But I'll be upfront, I think there's a bit of a contrivance to that. I don't think, as I read the provisions, that's what's intended, to just say carry on zoning wherever and just slap a UGB around it, and that takes care of the idea of strategic planning. Do you think we would find ourselves in a corner in terms of needing to refuse the submission or the relief sort if we found it was urban development and it didn't relate to the UGB provisions? Do you think we can just get to the point where we say, even if it doesn't sit with those UGB provisions and it is urban, do you think we can still find grounds to grant the relief?
Absolutely. I'll say yes.
Well,
I wanted to go back to this, yep. This sort of rezone it and slap a UGB. I don't know what your understanding of is of what is required of chapters 3 and 4, but I don't think it's let's look at where we should place the urban boundaries to accommodate sort of short to medium term needs. Or whatever horizon it is, that's not how it works, and the council hasn't done that. They've made no provision for growth for industrial use within Wakatipu. It hasn't done that, and so this is a developer-led initiative.
Good.
You can ask Mr. Giddens more about that, but I just don't agree with that starting assumption.
Well, that's very helpful, because I hadn't taken from the submissions that there was a clear part of it which was we can't rely on the current UGB because the council's got it wrong,
which is what
you've just said.
Well, I think Mr. Giddens says that in his evidence. He says there isn't sufficient land earmarked for industrial development.
I don't think he goes as far as saying the UGB is wrong. I think he says the council could have done a better job of zoning long-term land, but I don't think he's actually said the UGB is unreliable and
well, I don't think that we need to say it's unreliable, because my point is that I don't think that the council set out to place the UGB Well, I think implicitly the submission does.
Yep. I hadn't quite appreciated that, and that does, I think, open in my mind another avenue for us to pursue. Which is the so what question. If we find that the UGB is unreliable, should we actually use it as a straitjacket?
Yeah.
So that's a very helpful distinction. Thanks.
Mr. Munro, can I ask a follow-up question to that then? Because I had the same view. What actually is the purpose, in your view, from a legal figure, the purpose of the urban growth boundary, if it says the way you've just described it?
Yeah, well, I wondered in this context, because it seems as though it's a method that's been taken from... I mean, it's widely used throughout the country, but it's used differently, and it serves a different purpose in other plans. You know, the Auckland Unitary Plan, the Christchurch Plan, where you have got... That was very much based, initially, when PC Run was first promoted before the earthquakes, on a rationing approach with the view to trying to get intensification in the inner city and settlements along transportation routes and to achieve urban consolidation. That was the function of the urban growth boundary in that case. And it was there were greenfield areas identified for short to medium to long-term growth over a longer horizon, which then shrunk back, and urban boundaries, which effectively were greenbelt.
Yep.
You know, sort of they functioned as a greenbelt. And I have asked myself the question of what is the function of the UGB in this plan, and it doesn't seem to be the same or as effective as it is, for example, in and even though the strategic provisions and the provisions in Chapter 4 are written as though that is its purpose, it doesn't seem to work that way. It seems to follow the rezoning. It seems to be incremental. There isn't an urban growth boundary that earmarks future.
So yeah, it's not a strategic planning tool?
No, I don't think it is. I don't think it achieves that purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Munro.
Okay.
It's intended to change too.
Commissioner McLeod, anything for Ms. Stephen?
Not really. I mean, I'm thoroughly enjoying the discussion, I must admit. But the, because urban growth boundaries, my humble opinion coming into this, prior, relatively fresh, was that there were a line in the sand. But lines in the sand seem to get washed away by the tide. And the tide just seems to rise constantly in the Wakatipu. Oh my God, I can't believe I said the Wakatipu.
Yes,
the district.
We'll write that down.
Yeah.
Well, it does in this district because it isn't set in the RPS. There isn't an urban growth boundary, which can't be shifted.
Yep.
You're stuck with it, and that's a line. If you've got a line on a map and an RPS, it's a line in the sand that can't be moved unless it's initiated by the CRC. It isn't here, but also Mr. Giddens contemplates that the line will be moved, and he's pointing to a provision. I'll let him speak to it, but because he'll have something more to say about that if you're interested. But I don't understand its true purpose in this plan.
That is very helpful. Well, it's not helpful, but it's helpful.
Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, thank you. I just want to challenge that presumption around urban growth boundaries, because you're making the suggestion that we don't have sufficient capacity within the urban growth boundaries to provide not only from what the MPS requires of us, but actually significantly more. And all the data, all the capacity assessments we've had over the last few years tell us that we actually have, with the exception potentially of affordable housing and some industrial land needs, we actually have more than enough capacity within our existing zone land and our existing urban growth boundaries for our growth needs.
Well, for industrial development, my witnesses disagree. Mr. Giddens, I'll leave it to him.
The question was around the validity of the urban growth boundaries, and they don't. That's not challenged by the existence of the sufficiency of one zone or enough. It's the overall, we have more than enough capacity.
Oh, look, I'm not raising. Kaurna Capital is not raising a general challenge to the sufficiency of the urban growth boundary for all purposes in the plan. We're challenging the sufficiency of land identified, whether it's within the UGB or not, for general industrial use. And that is where Mr. Giddens will say that there isn't enough land.
That doesn't suggest whether that could or couldn't be supplied within the existing urban growth boundaries.
Well, Mr. Giddens has looked at that. He says that it can't be.
Wonder if you should wait, Commissioner, and talk to Mr. Giddens about it.
Thank you. You made the suggestion that rural industrial activities could be of an equivalent scale of what is proposed. In fact, that's probably another question for Mr. Giddens because it's plan related, so I'll leave them there. Thank you.
Yeah. Wait for Commissioner Dawson.
Yes, absolutely.
In answer to the question, Jim, you've said that in your view the urban growth boundary is something that follows decisions about where urban development should go.
In this plan.
So they identify areas available for growth of urban areas, so I guess you have to identify what's available for growth, and then in your view, the urban growth boundary is then mapped to define that after you've worked out where growth should go, for example. But you're not saying that there are no policies in chapters 3 or 4 that define where urban development should go?
No, I'm not saying that at all, and I want to make the point that I'm not saying that for all purposes that is the case. I'm addressing The comment that I made was specifically in terms of whether this is a UGB could be pursued as consequential relief. And but in terms of the broader question, there is only one other example that I'm aware of, and I stand to be corrected, and that's in relation to Ladies Mile, where there is an urban growth boundary around land that's not yet live zoned, but it's still been earmarked for high intensity residential use. So,
yes, so
the
yes,
analysis has
yes,
been undertaken.
Yes.
It's just that the zoning hasn't been included in the plan. So, so I think it necessarily does follow that you consider the suitability of potential blocks of greenfield land for a particular type of urban development. You might decide it doesn't need to be live zoned yet, but you know, if you're going to use an urban growth boundary as a sort of a green belt in the sense that Christchurch does and Auckland does, then you would go through that exercise. So I think even then you would still say, where is land that's capable of being developed? What zone is it appropriately developed for? And then you put the urban growth boundary around that. We're just doing this on a micro level in the context of this specific submission, and I'm saying that it's a permissible consequential change if you decide that the land is, it's appropriately zoned for industrial use.
Yes, and so in your view, the main decision is this appropriate for urban development of this particular nature?
Well, is it general industrial?
Yes, if that is considered to be urban development, there's a whole bunch of policies that talk about where urban development can
go. So that will determine whether or not you need to put an urban growth boundary around it. But I think, it's not just is it capable of being developed for urban development without...
of a particular nature.
It's got to be of a particular nature.
And then a more specific question. We visited the site at the end of June, I think. Yes. Towards the end of June.
Mid-June.
What had the installation of the gas facility started at that stage?
Yes.
I think so.
Yes. And
the work to install the gas facility was underway.
The consent was sought last year, and if I recall, the Tonkin and Taylor assessment said winter is its smelliest, so you might have noticed the odour. I expect you would have noticed the odour, because I think that the assessment refers to it's going to be particularly smelly over winter.
And this is the winter when they're doing the installation.
Yep.
All right, thank you. That's all.
Commissioner McLeod, you had final point?
One final point was just we were discussing the OPS and reverse sensitivity, and you said that the landfill wasn't considered regionally significant infrastructure. I wonder if you could expand on that for me, please.
Mr. Giddens can. I'm just relying on his...
In that case, I'll ask Mr. Giddens.
Because I just defined... I think it's a term that's defined.
Thank you.
It's in the PDP.
So, your first witness.
I'd like to call Ray Edwards first. Ray? Wakey, wakey? Your turn.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So how are we proceeding?
I'm waiting for Ray to start talking.
Everyone can hear me okay. I'm running on the assumption that the evidence in chief I provided has been taken as read.
That's correct.
I'll just run through some key points as to how this whole thing rolls, particularly in relation to the scope submission on this matter. I've had a very quick discussion with Mr. Bartlett, who's the traffic engineer on behalf of scope, and it would appear that the August 2019 transport assessment, where I looked at the wider network issues with this proposal, was not something he'd seen at the time he had written his submission, which would explain things. But the short version of it is that with this proposed development, there would need to be two considerations. The first one is what sort of intersection upgrade would be needed on State Highway 6 at the Victoria Flats intersection. And the second issue is dealing with wider road network flows on State Highway 6, given the capacity issues, particularly at the Shotover Bridge, as identified by the NZTA. In terms of the first one, we've just had the need for upgrading the Victoria Flats Road intersection with State Highway 6. At the moment, that intersection is located on a very straight section of State Highway 6, and it goes very gently uphill towards Queenstown. The design proposals that we've prepared that had been viewed by the NZTA is that with initial plan change development of the site, that it would need to be upgraded to a right turn-based style design with I'd be estimating around 100 metres of storage capacity in the right turn bay, which is big enough for 3 to 4 trucks plus some cars, or 2 trucks plus more cars. The critical period for consideration in terms of transport effects at the intersection is the right turn movement into Victoria Flats Road in the morning peak period, safely catering for that. And we've done intersection modelling of that that shows that with about 40% of site development based on land area, which approximates 15 hectares of developed land, that the right turn bay would start to fail in terms of capacity, and by that I mean people would be waiting in the bay too long. We then need to upgrade the intersection to a dual right turn lane roundabout, which is the same sort of thing you see closer to Glenda Drive, for example, 5 mile roundabout, just the same as that. In terms of the intersection design, we've had various meetings and consultation with the NZTA. They've been very helpful, and we have in writing from them that they agree that in terms of an intersection upgrade works, initially right turn bay, longer term roundabout is entirely appropriate, and they have agreed that there's no issues with upgrading the intersection on this straight section of State Highway 6. The only point that they have made is, wouldn't it be good if the roundabout option could also include access to the other land use activities on the straight section of State Highway 6, and in particular the quarry on the other side of the road, Oxbow, and the firearms club. That is easily able to be achieved. We have done a concept design of a roundabout for that the NZTA has seen. And all that would take over a period of time is just negotiating with the various landowners to have direct access. The roundabout will pick up the landfill as well. So in terms of dealing with the intersection, that is actually sorted in principle with dealing with this. Again, I remind the panel that 40% of site development area appears to be the trigger where a right turn bay would fall over in favour of a roundabout. In terms of wider network effects, I've been working on that since my evidence has been prepared, and I've completed more work on that, which I've been doing more this morning, actually, while the hearing has progressed. With 100% of site development, the NZTA has identified that the Shotover Bridge is the weak link on State Highway 6 in terms of providing for additional capacity. In terms of existing flows, the flows on State Highway 6 immediately west of the Shotover Bridge are quite a bit higher than what they are immediately east. We have used the flows immediately west for analysis because that's what the NZTA has asked us to do. That shows the analysis that I've undertaken, which is based on, how will I describe this? We've used traffic generation data from the council for Glenda Drive, and we've also correlated that with traffic generation data for a very similar industrial development in Chapman Road in Christchurch. We get almost identical results. What it shows is that with 100% of site development, the peak hour traffic flows, there is not the capacity at present to put that across the Shotover Bridge. But at 40%, which matches the trigger for a roundabout, there is the capacity to actually do that. You might ask, well, how does that work, given that in the peak hour periods it's almost gridlock? And the answer to that is quite straightforward. It's because with the site being located further east of Queenstown and Frankton, the peak hour traffic generation to the site is likely to be one of two things. Firstly, from Queenstown / Frankton, going in the opposite direction to the peak hour flows to everyone else. And the other one is in terms of Cromwell, it could actually pick up Cromwell employment traffic or commuter traffic that's already going to Queenstown, could instead be diverted into this site. So I call it contraflow capacity, that there is actually road network capacity in the opposite direction to the peak car traffic flow. So there is room. In the evening peak period, it's the same thing. You've got your main traffic flow existing is going eastbound towards Cromwell, or leaving Queenstown. Of course, this site here development would actually have most of its traffic going towards Queenstown. So again, it fills in a spare gap. The analysis that I've undertaken has been based on looking at the State Highway 6 traffic flows across the entire year. What I've analysed is for every single hour of the day that's been counted over the last year provided by the NZTA. I've looked at what is the busiest hour, what is the highest volume over the entire year that traffic was carried in each direction by State Highway 6 at the Shotover Bridge. And for all intents and purposes, it's 1,700 vehicles per hour. I've used that as a theoretical maximum capacity, and then I've compared the 85th percentile traffic volumes with development, and it comes out that at 40% site development, future predicted hourly flows at the Shotover Bridge will still be less than what the road carries and peak hour flows now. So it fits, basically. It fits quite nicely. In terms of when is the absolute peak for State Highway 6, of course, that's at Christmas time when, of course, a development of this nature wouldn't be operating. So that's why I've used the shoulders. When are the shoulders? They're November and March. So that analysis, that later analysis in terms of network flows is hot off the press. I actually finished it about half an hour ago. So I don't have written evidence about it, but what I can do is provide, if the panel was to entertain it, just copies of these graphs to show how it works. They're quite easy to follow. But it shows that at 40% site development, the road network has the capacity to accommodate this development. That in turn raises the question of, well, what do you do post 40% of development? And Mr. Giddens will talk to you about a site development rule that says that site development would be permitted up to 40% of land area. Beyond 40% of land area, it would be a restricted discretionary activity, with that discretion restricted to consideration of two things. One, intersection design at Victoria Flats Road, and two, road network effects, particularly at the Shotover Bridge. Has this approach been done before? And my experience, the answer is yes, it has. Three examples come to mind. One is the Clearwater Golf Resort in Christchurch, which used to access State Highway 1. They had a similar trigger rule for putting a roundabout in on State Highway 1. There was another one in Smith Street in Kaiapoi that I'm involved with for an industrial development that's quite large. And accessing Smith Street, which is just beside State Highway 1, there's rules in the Waimakariri area district plan that have certain trigger levels. And then you look at doing signals or intersection upgrades in that case. And I have not confirmed this, but I understand that on State Highway 1, the roundabout for Ravenswood and Pegasus, just north of Christchurch, was also undertaken based on rules at certain levels of development. I need to confirm that last one, but I'm pretty sure that's how it rolled. So it's been done before, and in my experience, we're doing the Smith Street review one right now, a rule like that, very, very simple rule, and it works really well. So what would happen if that rule was triggered? Quite simple. If you go beyond 40% restricted discretionary activity, naturally the council would identify the NZTA as an affected party. And to undertake any road upgrade works on State Highway 6, you need to have NZTA approval anyway. So it's very neat, it's very concise, and it's a solution that would allow some development now, but not major development until the road upgrade and network effects had all been agreed with the NZTA. So that neatly brings me back to the conclusion of my evidence in chief, which is there doesn't seem to be anything from a transport perspective in that I put in a deferred zoning. We've given that a bit more thought, and I've just changed that in my evidence in chief to now being this 40% site coverage approach. So zone it now, but have a site-specific rule with a limit on the traffic on the level of site development as a permitted activity. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Edwards, can I ask you first, you refer to positive messages from NZTA. Is that positive messages subsequent to the letter you have attached to your evidence dated 23 April? Because I thought that that was distinctly qualified.
It is distinctly qualified. We've had further conversations with them about that, dealing with Julie McMinn and also Richard Shaw in the Christchurch office, and we're working with them. I mean, we all agree on what the issues are that need to be resolved. The analysis that I've finished this morning hasn't been passed the NZTA yet, but certainly all the number crunching I've done shows that at 40%, it's basically not making anything worse on the Shotover Bridge than what it does in the November and March periods now. So there is capacity. The road will get busier. There was a question earlier from the panel, but I have the numbers on here. So at 100% site development, the two-way traffic volume on State Highway 6, the Shotover Bridge, would get to close to 41,000 vehicles per day. That's not going to work. That's well beyond the capacity for a two-lane arterial road. But at 40% development, it comes down to 32,000 vehicles per day. And we have two-lane arterial roads in far more built-up areas, Papanui Road and Christchurch, for example. That's been at over 28,000 vehicles per day, and it has a lot more side traction, like Mirabar Mall, etc., along the side of it. What I'm finding over the last 20 years is that two-lane arterial roads are able to carry a lot more traffic than what all the books actually suggest.
The other question I had for you is the... you've provided the example in terms of the suitability of a roundabout with the Frankton Road situation. I wondered whether they were distinguishable, because the open road speed, first of all, there's an open road speed limit coming up from the Victoria Bridge. Secondly, the roundabout would be more or less right at the end of a passing lane. Can you give me an example of a roundabout in an open of that is similar in those respects?
Not at the end of the passing lane, no, I can't. However, there's several roundabouts where in Christchurch, as part of the Southern Motorway extension, we have a 100-kilometre-an-hour speed limit with two-lane approaches into a roundabout. The other thing that needs to be kept in mind is it's looking highly likely that the speed limit on this road will reduce to 80 kilometres per hour. As part of the nationwide review of speed limits being undertaken by the NZTA, my recent experience of driving along the road is that it's in real-world operating speed is probably about 80 k's an hour anyway. The right turn bay design, what that does is it shortens the passing lane length to 550 metres or something like that, which meets NZTA design requirements for the length of a passing lane, such that it would be a single-lane approach past the intersection. With the roundabout, by the end, it's highly likely the road would be 80 k's an hour, and it would just simply be two approach lanes to a large-scale rural roundabout. But there's not really anything that exciting with that. Pretty standard traffic engineering design.
Commissioner Munro.
Thanks for that. Just to help me characterise and understand what's being proposed, what have you estimated as the likely maximum gross floor area that the zone could result in?
I'm not looking away from the camera. I'm just going to my other screen where I have that sort of information. Bear with me one moment.
No, for sure.
I do have it here. I've undertaken all of this based on site areas and then allowing for a certain amount of site coverage. But I can... Oh, here we go, found it. An average site coverage ratio of 28%, say 30%, the maximum single level gross floor area I've calculated is 85,000 square metres.
So as I understand the relief that's been sought, a building coverage of up to 80% has been sought. Is there any reason you used a level of coverage much lower than what's been requested?
The reason I used the lower coverage is we actually worked out site coverage areas in Glenda Drive,
right,
but also with other industrial developments.
Okay.
And that 30% scenario is based on working out if you have a certain site area and you have a building of a certain size, how much land do you need for parking, how much land do you need for landscaping, how much land do you lose for roads and access to it, and all those sorts of things. And in my experience with what I would call pretty standard industrial style developments, it's unusually site coverage much beyond 35% by the time you allow for all the parking, landscaping and other influences.
Do you think that
in terms of the 80%, I'm not too sure what Mr. Giddens is referring to with that.
I wonder whether I could just explain. I mentioned in my opening that we were going to be proposing amended rules, further amended, and that is one of the rules. The site coverage has been reduced to 30%.
Yeah, it's a range over three areas. There's one area that still remains at 80, and then there's
which
just goes down to 25%.
Okay, thank you. Moving on then, so one of the things that we'll have to figure out when we're evaluating whether this proposal is urban development or not is this idea called cumulative traffic generation. And I don't think that necessarily means a peak hour generation one way or something else. So the first thing I'd ask you is your thoughts on what you think cumulative traffic generation might mean in respect of a proposed zone. And then secondly, I'd like you to tell me what you think the cumulative traffic generation in whatever metric you think is relevant might be.
So is this referred to in a rule in the district plan?
It's to do with the definition of urban development.
Okay. All right, well, I'm not familiar with the context of it, but cumulative traffic generation in standard engineering terms is looking at if you have an existing traffic flow, for example, what's going on State Highway 6 now, and then you add in development and you have a cumulative increase in the traffic flow on that frontage road, and you add in more development, you'll have a further cumulative increase. That's how I would interpret that.
Okay. And then you have given some evidence, for instance, in terms of overall flows on Frankton Bridge, etc., etc., so I can follow that through. If I were to ask you a more focused question of what would the total traffic generation across a typical weekday for the zone based on your 85,000 square metres per one level GFA, what would you estimate that to be?
I have that here. I heard the question earlier, so I worked it out.
Thank you.
Well, I'm going to make sure I give you the right number. I've completed two scenarios. One is with 100% of site development, because I started with that and quickly worked out that the shot over bridge flows weren't going to work.
Yep.
And that is around 40,000 vehicles per day. At 40% site development, there's 40 there. That's the 32,000 vehicles per day they referred to earlier.
Okay, thank you for that. So if I were to ask you, based on your experience as a traffic expert, would you regard a site of 91 hectares, an area generating up to 40,000 vehicles a day, in your experience, would you characterise that as more urban or more rural?
Urban.
Okay. My last question for you just relates to a bit more of a nuts and bolts item. A lot of the roading infrastructure that might need various forms of upgrade as a consequence of the zone proceeding would be state highway infrastructure.
Yes.
Which is different to a council infrastructure that, that things like financial contributions and things in resource consents might more typically address. You satisfied that any mechanism that might require some engagement with NZTA has been or otherwise can be integrated into the provisions?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's been done before with rule sets like this. If I can just add, the beauty of this approach is that it's all very well working out a perfect development scenario with optimum site coverages and all these things, such as what I've done. But it's hypothetical. The advantage of these staged approaches, in my experience, is it allows you to actually go out and monitor it. And where Mr. Giddens and I and Ms. Stephen were at about a week ago is, how do you do a Section 128 type review condition when it's not a resource consent and we're instead writing a rule? And the answer is, I have done all this extra number crunching and worked out, well, actually, it's going to develop over time. Based on what we know now, it's going to max out at about 40% before the shot-over bridge is at capacity. What can happen is that at 40% of site area development, we can actually measure what the traffic generation is. That would probably lead into the question of, well, what happens if it's higher or lower? The reality is that we still have some future unknowns in this district. A key one that I'm keen to see the council pursue, and it looks like it is doing, is the concept of park and ride. Because there is no spare geometric capacity closer to Queenstown and State Highway 6A to do more lanes and things. So, all right, reduce the number of vehicles. And with this, the discussions I've had with Mr. Henderson from very early days, I've been promoting park and ride. And I was alluded to a fortnight ago that the council is also pursuing that with land purchased by Lake Hayes. So beyond that 40% thing, the idea is that we could go out and very easily monitor the performance of the state highway that's continuously counted. We can monitor the performance of the intersection that's very easily counted. We can update the modelling based on that data and make a call as to what further development, if any, is actually workable from a traffic engineering effects perspective.
Okay, well, thank you. I've got no more questions. And Ms. Stephen, thanks also for just helping me on that building coverage matter.
Thank you.
Mr. Dawson?
The examples that you gave of triggers in other developments in and around Christchurch for undertaking particular works or upgrades on roads, well, at least two of them related to a roundabout on the state highway. So a particular work which could be identified, and that's sort of similar to what you're proposing at the intersection of Victoria Flats Road and the state highway. But the work that would be required to upgrade the state highway down at Shotover Bridge and Shotover Flats seems to be a different sort of order of magnitude or a different level of difficulty of ensuring that it gets done to a capacity to or is it able or even potentially able to be done to deal with full development from the site. How do you envisage that working as part of a restricted discretionary application?
The approach I've taken with this is actually to look at it a different way. The first time I looked at it was to follow what we traffic engineers tend to do, is take the existing volume, work out some estimates of future predicted traffic flows and go, what do we need to build the road to accommodate that? We don't have that luxury here. We have an issue with the Shotover Bridge being it is what it is. And also, as I said earlier, State Highway 6A, last 10 years where the work by the NZTA down there has, in my opinion, pretty much taken the geometric capacity of that road to its maximum. So the road's a finite resource, and I don't think you can do a lot more with it to improve mid-block capacity. So I took the different approach and said, well, all right, let's find out what that mid-block capacity actually is, Shotover Bridge being the example. The NZTA said that's the critical point in the network from their perspective, and as I said earlier, it's the immediately west of the bridge, Tucker's Beach Road, is where the highest volumes occur. I've identified what is the highest peak hourly volume in each direction and gone, right, we know it gridlocks when it's at peak volume, it's maximum volume. And then I've worked backwards from that and said, well, all right, we know it's a contraflow situation here. what is the capacity, and then working backwards from that, knowing known generation rates, how much land area could be developed, and that's what worked out the 40% thing. So we're not actually talking about upgrading the road down at Shotover Bridge or on State Highway 6A or through Frankton for that matter. What I'm talking about is using existing spare geometric capacity that's already there. And the reason that that works is because the location of the site generates its peak traffic flow directions in the opposite direction to existing situation.
But once you get beyond, I mean, by the time you get to the restricted discretionary point, the 40%'s been done, or 39.9 or whatever, and that capacity's been taken up. How is anyone going to make a decision at that point as to whether a restricted discretionary should be granted for further development of the site beyond the 40% when the capacity's been all used up in the State Highway and that Shotover Bridge, Shotover Flats areas?
Yeah, that's actually quite straightforward. By making it restricted discretionary, the council has the ability to seek a Section 95 approval. They also have the ability to decline a consent. So what happens is that, the way I see it working, is exactly the same as Pegasus, for example, is at that point in time, the traffic flow conditions are monitored and the traffic modelling work that's been undertaken is updated based on conditions at that time. And it may well be that at 40% there isn't the capacity at Shotover Bridge to allow further development of the Cadrona cattle site. And that's a risk that the applicant has to take. But equally, there's other things happening around the planet at the moment that are actually changing transport modes. For example, as I said, park and ride. That's the most obvious one. Another thing that's been mooted in discussions between the applicant and myself was, well, why isn't there a public bus service connecting all these things? Cromwell, Cadrona Cattle, Lake Hayes, Frankton, and Queenstown. You know, the numbers must be there. So the idea is at 40%, you can actually suck it and see. There's a risk for the applicant beyond that point in terms of the traffic issues. But below that point, I'm quite relaxed that we're not making things worse. We're using existing capacity. So what would happen then is you apply for consent, you're at 39.9%, you apply for consent, the council says, yep, we want Section 95 approval from the NZTA. We do the modelling work with the consultation with the NZTA, and the NZTA does not provide that Section 95 approval. So then the applicant's got two choices. It either withdraws the application or proceeds to a hearing with the NZTA as a limited notified party. The reality is, because this site's providing access to the state highway, the NZTA always retains control. That's the beautiful part about it. So if the NZTA just keeps saying no, 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 well, then it doesn't go any further.
When they don't actually retain control, other than at the intersection, they're just an affected party when it comes to written approvals.
No, because at 40%, the NZTA might not agree to the roundabout at that time. They said that in principle, it geometrically can be, you can fit it in there, and you can, easily. But that's not a guaranteed approval from them. The letter that we have from them so far just simply states, yeah, that is an idea and concept is a workable solution. But the NZTA has signalled quite clearly in the letter appended to my evidence that the road network's effects issue still needs to be considered. And that's the stuff that I'm discussing with you this morning and the mechanisms to how we'd make sure that actually happens.
So you're relying on them turning down the roundabout to manage effects further downstream at Shotover Bridge?
Essentially, the 40% threshold, yes.
All right, well, there's been a lot of note-taking going on for such a major development. Thank you.
Commissioner Smith?
Yeah, thank you. I've just got one question, and that relates to when you're measuring the 40%, were you doing that against existing capacity in the road or the plan-enabled demand on the road? So I'm just thinking about the unexercised zoning across the Wakatipu that will continue to increase demand on the, particularly the Shotover Bridge, which you acknowledge was the constraint point. Have you taken that into account?
The analysis I undertook in August 2019 was based on extrapolating traffic flows at known growth rates to the design year of 2028. So there's discussion in that assessment that talks about growth rates for the last 4 or 5 years as a graph with a green line and a blue line. So I am working, when I did that work, I was looking forward 10 years. It's now looking forward 8 years.
Based on growth rates or plan-enabled growth?
Well, what I've been doing is by if you allow for a continuation of existing measured growth rates, that is the only thing that can make that growth happen is further land development. So by projecting a current or recent growth rates out to a future design year, you're allowing for traffic growth to be created by other development that's already been anticipated within the basin.
Yeah, I just wonder whether using an existing growth rate, if a particular land resource is depleted, then there won't be that the growth rate won't continue at the same rate across that corridor. But equally, if there's additional land zones in that corridor, that the growth rate could continue to increase or be much greater. I mean, you know, Lake Hazel State and Shotover Country are the perfect example. If they didn't exist, the growth rate wouldn't be there. But the fact is that they have produced an enormous demand on the Shotover Bridge.
I agree, and that's one of the joys of land use, is how you cater for that demand and how you manage the transport network to accommodate that. But the concept's still exactly the same. Here we have a situation where the constraint's been identified as being the Shotover Bridge. Okay, fine. What I've done is I've looked at the most recent count data from the NZTA and worked out what is the highest volume per hour across the whole year in each direction and said, all right, that's it maxed out. We know that was highly likely to have been a gridlock situation, therefore that is the maximum capacity. And then I've worked backwards from there to work out how much more land capacity can be developed on site. The other thing that needs to be kept in mind is that with the growth rate projection, you've rightly picked up that it assumes that land use development in the basin would continue at the same rate as it recently has, and there's no guarantee of that. But at least by making that assumption, you're increasing your ambient flow that you're adding your traffic onto, so you're taking a conservative approach with it. I would
yeah,
be
I'm
pretty
sure,
confident.
I'm not sure that, I'd be interested in a more discrete look at the land use and how it enables, how it relates to traffic demand rather than a linear curve of current growth rates. But I'll leave it there for now. Thank you.
Mr. Hill?
Just one question. You said you spoke to Mr. Bartlett for scope. Does he agree with you now?
Agree in terms of what?
Well, in terms of his evidence, you said he hadn't looked at the 2019 valuation, the work that you had done. You said he hadn't, and I assume you discussed it with him. Did he have an aha moment, or?
We met last week after the hearing for the storage unit proposals for the site. We discussed, just life in general, staff are hearing for about 5-10 minutes, but my understanding was he wasn't aware of the August 2019 work. Certainly his evidence reads that he hasn't seen that work, because the issues that he raises and the possible solutions that might be required are exactly what's discussed in my August 2019 work.
So we're going to hear from him tomorrow. So he didn't say, I now understand what you're saying, or agree with
him? I think you could take his position as being one of that, yes. I mean,
okay,
confirm that with him tomorrow, but
yeah.
My understanding of the situation, the thing with scope's quite simple. They are required under their consent to monitor the need for a right turn bay, is my understanding of the situation. For the storage unit hearing last week, they were pushing the barrow that the right turn bay was needed with the storage units. And I was simply saying, actually, no, it's not. It doesn't generate enough traffic to justify it. But what I'm saying for this hearing is with more land development off Victoria Flats Road, you do need it. We've done the right turn bay design. It's easily accommodated on site with very little work to be undertaken on the state highway. But it can be done, no problem. And then there's a point in time, and I've said 40%, where you need the roundabout.
Okay, no, that's fine, thank you. Can I just signal that I think in terms of the 40% rule, we need to probably put questions to Mr. Giddens about how that will actually work. Is it the hapless next person who decides to apply and is then caught up with having to provide the roundabout, or whether it's going to become likely to come as all of the rest of the development. So we'll pick that up later on.
Commissioner McLeod.
Segues beautifully to the question I was going to ask, which is with the Mr. Edwards, thank you for your evidence. With the intersection upgrades, so you identified a right turn passing, a right turn queuing lane that was identified in, and I'm assuming that the this would be something that would be onerous on the developer to install and pay for.
Yes.
And so, pushing that further out, is would that the same then apply to the roundabout at the 40% mark?
Yes.
So, given that you've identified that the short of a bridge is then the weak link, when we get to that 40%, are you suggesting that Cadrona Cattle Company will play for a new bridge over the short of it?
No, it's quite the opposite. What I'm suggesting is that is the weak link in the network, so to speak. So that's your finite point of capacity. So you work backwards from that. You can't add any more traffic onto the shot over bridge without building more bridge or lane extensions or widening it somehow. And I don't think any of that's realistically feasible. What I'm saying is, okay, you hold that and you work backwards from spare capacity on the road network to then work out how much land development you could accommodate. And this is what I was saying earlier. It may well be that at 40%, the traffic network just doesn't have the capacity to allow more development of the site.
And with that point, and please excuse my simplistic explanation of this, but I'm just trying to get this clear in my head. Is being 40% of a development, and isn't that being like half pregnant? You either are a development or you're not. So is it realistic in your mind to, as a traffic expert, to anticipate that development should stop at 40% because of an external constraint, which is NCTA, and is this something that is generally applied?
And this is the thing that I raised earlier, that there is a risk for the applicant or the submitter in this case.
I get the risk, but is it realistic? Is it realistic?
I think to work out whether it's realistic or not would depend on the actual economics of developing the site. It's not something I'm an expert in. But all I've done is I've been asked to look at this, and what I've come back with is there isn't the network capacity to do 100% site development at the moment. There is the network capacity to do 40% site development. It's just a coincidence that 40% is the same number whether you need the roundabout as well, so that's just convenient. But beyond that, I don't think it's my call to say we shouldn't even kick off this development at all. What I've been asked to look at is, well, what can the road network handle?
Yeah. And I was gratified to hear you respond to my fellow commissioner's question about including the known growth rates. Did that include the growth rates out of the district, i.e. the traffic coming from Cromwell and the growth of Cromwell?
Yes, it does. Because any commuter traffic travelling between Cromwell and Queenstown would be picked up in the ambient growth rates being recorded on State Highway 6.
Thank you. And final question. I'm fully aware of the work that NZTA are doing with regard to the speed limits, but you mentioned that the real-world operating speed is 80 kilometres an hour, and I just want you to clarify that with regard to this specific site, because I travel this road reasonably regularly, and at certain specific times of the day, and the peak hours being the most specific ones, and I'll use the term again loosely, it becomes a bit of a racetrack, and 80 kilometres an hour, specifically on this site where you've just gone across the bridge, you're accelerating up into an overtaking lane, which I take may or may not be there, but is that real world operating speed of 80 kilometres an hour still realistic, given that you're dealing with cars that are overtaking and heading into a potential intersection treatment which may be a roundabout?
And under the current 100 kilometre per speed limit, I would say no. But the reality is, we all know that the speed limit on this section, well, New Zealand wide state highway network, they're going to change. And the NZTA has signalled that there will be basically no going ups. That's been done in the Waikato and Auckland 110, and I don't think it's going to be extended anywhere further. Everything's basically going to be coming down. and the discussions I've had with the NZPA so far, and they won't allow themselves to be pinned down, which is a bit frustrating, but it's been 80 k's an hour, all the indications. There's already sections of the State Highway 6 coming through Lake Hawea and stuff that are 80 k's an hour now. So all it's really doing is filling the gaps with a consistent speed limit.
And thank you for that. And given the length of time that the developers have been taking to get this particular development in some shape or form off the ground, we may all be flying around in drones by the time we get to that. So thank you very much, Mr. Edwards. That's all from me.
Commissioner Dawson, you had one more question?
Just one clarification, Mr. Edwards. It's very clear that the 40% is the point where you think the roundabout should be looked at the intersection. What is the trigger, or is it an initial starting point that the right turn bay be developed?
Day one.
Day
you do
one.
That from the very start, yeah, for construction traffic.
So that needs to be that would need to be a sort of precondition in your view.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Edwards. We hear from Mr. Angus now.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Is that better?
Yeah.
There we go.
Thank you. Yep.
You can hear?
Yes.
Okay. I will follow the format of Mr. Edwards and just give a brief summary of our submission and then take questions, if that's acceptable.
Absolutely fine. Mm.
Right, so our market for industrial land in the QLDC, there's land in Wanaka, Broadley, Cromwell and Queenstown. We've concentrated on the Queenstown market because this land is on the Queenstown side of the Kara Gorge, doesn't necessitate travelling, the cost, indirect and direct cost of travelling through that gorge. And per se, this land will provide an increase of supply for Queenstown industrial land. And a reasonably significant increase in supply in terms of area, but more than it will provide a supply of land at the lower end cost of the market. Obviously, not all land is homogeneous and carrots and what have you. We're now living in a COVID world, and trying to predict what's going to happen in markets is proving a virtual impossibility, because assumptions are changing daily. The effect on demand for future industrial land is a little unknown, but one would expect there's going to be a diversification in the Queenstown area away from tourism, and given the mooted government initiatives, there will probably be a growth in smaller scale industrial development, of which there's a limited supply of land. Industrial land supply has been constrained in Queenstown and has always had a significant high price. In some cases have made it very difficult to demonstrate economic development feasibility for smaller businesses. On the supply side, what is likely to happen? In the short term, one wouldn't expect to be large-scale industrial development. And, of course, in the past, we've had the reallocation of industrial land to big-box retail. That's not expected. Would that, everything else being equal, expected to allow for a fall in price? It possibly would. But the issue is that a lot of this land is tightly held, and the existing owners have the opportunity of holding on to the land, given they've got a small holding cost at current interest rates and returns, and the supply of land or the price of land, industrial land, may not necessarily be expected to drop significantly for existing land supplies. So an increase in supply, which this land would provide, should bring in competitive tension to the market, allow an alternative for smaller, new entrants and lower scale industrial development, and overall have a positive effect to promote that. And that is pretty much a very brief summary of our argument.
Thank you very much, Mr. Angus. Start with Commissioner Hill.
Dignity, just one question for me, and you may or not be able to answer it. Economics and supply, we've just been talking to a traffic expert about this 40%, and after that you get into what I imagine is a fairly expensive upgrade of the state highway, and what that might do in terms of the supply of the 60% remaining. I think the 40% takes you to about 36,000 square metres if the 85,000 is to be bigger. What's your projection or view in terms of that land then coming to the market from an economic perspective?
In terms of price or in terms of whether the cost of the cost of the road, Alec, is the upgrade of the cost of the road going to be justified?
Yes.
But going to be able to be reflected on? Well, one of the issues there, I mean, you know, whether I can answer that, all the issues that I haven't got the full details of the cost of the road.
No.
But that cost will be allocated over both the industrial land and any other development in the area. So there's other land in the vicinity of this that will also benefit from that road upgrade. So that would have to be allocated and internalised to cost all of the land there, or both industrial and other zonings. So the issue comes back to whether that cost is justified.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it is a question, how long is a piece of string, really? So thank you for that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McLeod. Commissioner Munro. Commissioner Dawson.
When you've assessed the economic benefits to the district of developing this land, how have you weighed that against the economic costs that Ms. Hampson has identified of locating this site at a distance from the existing urban areas in terms of the locational costs, the costs on the roading infrastructure, the long travel costs for workers, those sorts of broader costs that she's identified?
Okay. Well, in terms of the framework of looking at that, you've got to look at what the alternatives are. So if there's a constraint for land supply and directly related to Queenstown, we're going to have to look at options outside Queenstown. One of the options which some operators are using is relocating, you know, using land in Cromwell. So that's got the additional cost, direct and indirect costs of transport to Cromwell. So if you work back from the alternatives that are looked at, the justification for increased roading will fit into that equation.
So if you were going to look at considering the costs and benefits in the broad sense of this site versus alternative options, wouldn't you do some form of options analysis? Or wouldn't the council or somebody look at the wide range of options and weigh the costs and benefits of different sites in order to achieve the most appropriate option in terms of industrial development for this part of the district?
So whether the total cost of infrastructure are justified by the reduced price of land? Well,
that, amongst other costs.
Yep. So that's one of the issues that which Mr. Edwards has also looked at.
Mm-hmm. All right, that's it. Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Smith.
No questions, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Angus. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
There we go, Mr. Giddens.
Yes, Mr. Gold. And I think Mr. Giddens might be able to help you with more information on that last question.
Yes,
so I've got a summary and updated rule package.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Giddens, please proceed.
Just for a start, I'm going to try and respond to about three questions in one, if I can, just in regard to the urban growth boundaries, locations, and some of the some of the queries that came up. Planning Map 13 of the PDP is quite useful. That's essentially the snapshot overview of the Wakatipu Basin, which shows all the zonings, urban growth boundaries, outstanding natural landscapes. It shows the outstanding natural landscapes and the like. Okay. Sure.
Could you step up planning map 13, as it's been referred to, pretty please? Is that a picture? Thank you.
The interesting point on that plan is probably in response to Commissioner Smith's questions as to the council's had evidence from Ms Hampson about there being capacity within the urban growth boundaries or potential capacity for industrial land in the Wakatipu. And I think an examination of that plan, an employee to do it, is quite useful just to see where the urban growth boundary is located respective to existing zones and respective to the outstanding natural landscape boundaries. And I will make one point of clarification on Ms Stevens' comments earlier on. She mentioned that Ladies Mile was within the urban growth boundary. On planning map 13, it's not. Currently, my understanding that's going to be addressed as part of a future stage of the PDP review. So although it is earmarked for urban development, it's currently not within an urban growth boundary.
Sorry, I missed that. What were you referring to?
On planning map 13, earlier on, Ms Stevens said that the Ladies Mile was within the urban growth boundary, and if you look at that map, it actually sits outside of the urban growth boundary as it stands at the moment. And the point I was making, yes, and I think that's trying to link into Commissioner Munro's question as to what comes first. Is it the urban growth boundary or is it the zoning? As it stands at the moment with the urban growth boundary in the Wakatipu, it's limited. It's very limited. And I'd employ you to look at that. That's page map 13 of the PDP. So just off, I may start with my summary then. Ah, 13.
We just tend to look at the online version.
This is the one you want.
The one you got your. If you click on that, yes.
So is your point that in the Wakatipu Basin, or in the Queenstown area, the urban growth boundary very closely follows the existing zoning and doesn't provide swathes, well, not through stages one and two anyway,
yes,
for future growth?
Correct.
It's sort of like the urban boundary.
Yes, that's correct. And I think when you compare it to the Canterbury Regional Policy Statement, which I think Ms Stevens commented on before, that's a fixed urban growth boundary essentially, and we don't have that in the Queenstown Otago context at the moment. So I think that's quite a key point between the two. And just coming back to one of Commissioner Smith's queries before about the capacity and the fact that you've had evidence from the council saying there is capacity, going through Ms Hampton's report, she does put quite a few tags on the usability of that land. I.e. there's industrial land that's owned by the airport, which I think she makes the assumption that it's more likely that land would be used for airport-related industrial activities. And then there's Coneburn. And Coneburn is, from my understanding, a look at the most recent consents, is that there is no infrastructure connected to that at present. I think there's consents in place or in process to try and move that forward. I understand there's still a quarry operating on that. So it's not a ready zone. And outside of that...
Not shovel ready, to use a current phrase.
Certainly not shovel ready. And then outside of those areas, you're dealing with, or you're faced with, the Queenstown Industrial Zone off Gorge Road, Galinda Drive, the area on Frankton Flats. And I think when you look at capacity, you also need to look at what the rules of those zones enable too. And that they actually are quite restrictive in terms of pure industrial activities. And when I go through my summary, I do have some criticisms of the proposed zone, but in the sense of it being applied to a greenfield site, I actually think it's not bad. I think it's not a bad framework at all. So it depends on how you apply it. So if I may, I'll just go through my summary that I presented to you there. Just one, the proposal was to seek the industrial general zone over the Victoria Flats land. That land is zoned rural and within designation 76 and also Gibson character zone. That land zoned rural is also within an O&L under the PUP. And the relief sought by Cardrona Cattle Company is responsive to these attributes within the environment. And I just want to address some of the comments from Mr. Place. It's fair to say that we have divergent opinions on a few matters, and I do think Mr. Place has used a few sloppy language comments about some of my opinions, and I'm sure Mr. Place and I will address it over a cold beer or a nice warm coffee at some point, but I just do want to make that clear to the Commission that they should really see them for what they are, the differences of opinion, and just quite particular on that wording. In my opinion, the proposal represents the only opportunity in the Wakatipu, and I stress that the Wakatipu, under Stage 3 for a true greenfield industrial zone to be established. Ms Hampson acknowledges that there is a demand for industrial zoning in the Wakatipu, but considers that this should be evaluated under the future development strategy at some stage in the future. The other area that Ms Hampson refers to as having potential future ability is near Coneburn, at the foot of the Remarkables, which shares similarities to the Cardrona cattle land, being outside an urban growth boundary and near and within an O&L. And I can point that to you if, in where you see in the bottom left of the plan behind you, that's the Jack's Point zone. The Coneburn land is the pink area to the immediate right of that. And you can see that's within the red urban growth boundary and within the O&L. It sits outside of the O&L.
So isn't it that that's showing that it's inside the UGB, not outside?
Oh, sorry, it's inside the UGB as it stands at the moment. But any future area, if that's considered outside of that, and would be outside of the urban growth boundary because it's all zoned.
So you say the future potential is near Coneburn, which is outside the UGB.
Yes.
So what you're saying is that the existing Coneburn, albeit not shovel-ready and not yet developed, is inside the UGB.
Yes, correct.
But you're talking about an expansion of that.
Yes, I'm talking about an expansion, yes.
Okay.
And just to clarify that point for me, the expansion would be in this area?
Yeah, my understanding would be further further south.
This area?
Yes, correct. But that, for my reading of Ms Hampson's report, is that would be subject to further assessment and further evaluation. It was identified in the report as an area of potential.
Thank you.
Paragraph 4, my evidence is sceptical as to what will be achieved through the general industrial zone in the Wakatipu. And I do say this because the proposed modifications to the existing established industrial zones are more akin to tinkering around the edges, in my opinion. The new provisions are generally applied in zones that are significantly developed and include existing activities that the zone is now seeking to avoid or prohibit. In effect, outside of the Cardrona cattle land, I consider that the general industrial zone will achieve little and certainly provide minimal assistance in adding any meaningful capacity or affordability to industrial land in the Wakatipu. And again, I stress in the Wakatipu. And notwithstanding my criticisms of the zone, I consider that it is a relatively well-framed when it comes to greenfield sites. Taking advice from Mr. Milne in regard to the landscape matters, I've focused on specific changes in relation to the land and have further dissected the zone to relate to to that land within the buffer of Designation 76 and that land outside of it. Within the buffer, I've suggested further prohibition of certain activities and a stronger prohibition policy to the benefit of the landfill. I've attached my amended provisions as A. Turning to the landfill, Mr. Place emphasises the importance of the landfill without examining what the buffer is and what substance it has under the plan. The buffer as a method to achieve the assumed purpose of protecting the landfill from incompatible activities is hollow and of little substance in planning terms. Designation 76 does not place any controls on the activities within the buffer. The controls on activity within the buffer land is the same as any other rural zone land, i.e. the zone rules apply. So there are permitted activity provisions that allow occupation of that buffer zone. And Section 176 of the RMA restricts any activity that may hinder or prevent the public work from occurring under the designation, which requires an assessment of any such activity on its merits and is not in itself prohibited. And just on that point, the example I'll give you is the off-road adventures commercial recreation activity, and I referred to that in my evidence in chief. That enables around 5,000 to 6,000 users of that activity per annum within the buffer zone, and at the time it was authorised via resource consent, but under the current PPP as it stands, it would be a permitted activity. And also of relevance, it didn't require 176 approval as potentially hindering or preventing the designation. So I'm firm of the opinion that the amended general industrial zone I've outlined has the effect of prohibiting and avoiding activities, and I'll happily talk you through these provisions after my summary. The avoiding activities that could be incompatible with the landfill, and in the policy sense this is significant because under the current rural zoning, incompatible activities in the buffer only need to be managed and controlled. And under the proposed industrial zoning, incompatible activities in the buffer will be prohibited and avoided.
Does that word management control come from a policy?
Yes, it does. It's
in the utilities chapter?
It's actually in the utilities chapter 30, and also in it's replicated in chapter 21, rural. This, in my opinion, is a considerable benefit arising from the proposal and consideration of how the rezoning and future activities within the buffer area will support the continued operation of the landfill. Scope Resources, as a further submitter and confirmed trade competitor to Cardrona Cattle Company, have raised two issues, reverse sensitivity and traffic effects. I understand that their issues are now confined to the rezoning of the Cardrona Cattle land that is located within the designation buffer. Scope's evidence on reverse sensitivity has been limited to the effects of odour. My evidence goes to some length to confirm the extent of lawful operation of the landfill and evaluate the proposal in that context. The provisions I've recommended prohibit and avoid incompatible activities from their buffer land, and a note that Cardrona Cattle Co. have also offered an odour easement that could be incorporated into the rule framework. So turning to the traffic effects, you've heard from Mr. Edwards, I won't labour those points, but just in regard to a couple of points that were raised, I believe it might have been Commissioner Dawson, in terms of the effects on the bridge. One of the, and actually Commissioner Smith as well, about future rezonings. From my understanding, there are no other urban rezonings in play at present, other than what's shown on Planning Map 13. The only area that I understand is going to be considered is Ladies Mile. So the issue with the bridge.
If I may, partly what I was exploring there was the existing zonings, including, you know, the continued development of infill in Shot Up Country and Lake Hayes Estate, the development that's enabled by the Wakatipu Basin Precinct zone, the continued development of Arrowtown Retirement Village and infill in Arrowtown. It's the rest of the development across the basin effectively, and you know, certainly from the Wakatipu Stream 24 hearings last, you know, certainly aware that that isn't insubstantial. You know, it, you know, and unexecuted exercise building platforms in the Wakatipu Basin, which equally are not insubstantial. So there, cumulatively, there is a significant amount of additional demand yet to be placed, that's already consented, yet to be placed on the Shotover Bridge, and that's what I was particularly interested in.
I understand the point, and I know with the Wakatipu Basin Rural Amenity Zone in particular, I think there was in the initial study with the rezoning, I think they predicted another 600 to 700 houses, I think, coming out of the lifestyle precinct. Admittedly, that was as part of the initial Section 32 analysis. I think the point I was trying to respond to was the pressures on the bridge will be an issue that come up with Ladies Mile redevelopment in any case, and I think it is an issue that's going to have to be addressed.
I think NZTA's position that during that phase was that even the existing exercise development would see it reach that point.
Yes,
without adding anything on top of it. In fact, I think their submission was against a number of the rezonings in the Wakatipu Basin that there's nothing left to give on the Shotover Bridge, so they wouldn't support. But anyway.
Turning to the landscape, Mr. Milne has undertaken the first principles assessment of the Cardrona Cattle Company site and proposed zone. A relatively small portion of the site, zoned rural, is demarcated O&L under the PDP. Mr. Milne has concluded that, subject to controls on the scale and nature of the development, the zoning is appropriate within the landscape, maintaining the rural character and consolidating development in areas of the site that have a higher capacity to absorb such development. Throughout my evidence, I've commented on the urban development policies in the PDP, and I've consistently viewed the identification of an urban growth boundary around the zone as an inevitable consequence of requesting an industrial zoning. On reflection, it does not appear that the zone in itself would constitute urban development, given Mr. Milne's suggested provisions and on my reliance of his landscape evaluation. Urban development broadly means development that is not of a rural character, and is further premised on its scale, intensity, visual character and the dominance of built structures. And I'll also add there some of the comments Mr. Commissioner Munro mentioned before in questioning to Mr. Edwards. Putting Mr. Milne's view to one side, it's highly likely it would take a reasonable amount of development and to create tension with the definition of urban development. If the Commission was minded to support the request and found that the zoning would constitute urban development, then I consider that a consequential change would be defining an urban growth boundary around the zone, but that would not be critical to the relief sought. In terms of productive land, the Otago Regional Policy Statement contains policy that directs where the soil is significant. The land is not classified as Land Use Capability 1, 2 or 3E in accordance with the New Zealand Land Resource Inventory, and the policy direction is such that the soil on the Cardrona Cattle Co site land is not significant soil in the context of that policy. A note for completeness that I've been involved in a number of consenting projects in Victoria Flats since 2005, and a note that that includes for every landowner that's had that's got Gippsland character zone land, and at every turn that land has been discounted both by the landowners and the council because of the climatic conditions, which is obviously a factor of productivity. I understand that this is why there are no buy-ins in this part of the valley. And I note that all landowners that have land zoned Gippsland character on the valley floor have also sought industrial zoning under this chapter. Mr. Plate's purports are misled in my interpretation of Mr. Dice's evidence. I've simply applied logic, and that is paragraph 6.47 of his evidence raises an issue with industrial activities affecting grape growing, and I consider the effect of the landfill in that same context. The same could be expected from the consented but yet to be developed asphalt batching plant within the Gippsland character zone. To overlook Mr. Dicey's comment would be to overlook the receiving environment, in my view. And both Mr. Place and Mr. Dicey seem to have overlooked the fact that there are no grapes or any other productive crop growing in Victoria Flats. To turn to hazards and infrastructure, Mr. Bond considers that further information is required to evaluate whether a landslide hazard impacts the site. I acknowledge that further assessment is warranted, but consider the qualitative risk is low, which is a reference to Mr. Bond, and that this will be appropriately addressed as part of future consenting processes. In terms of infrastructure, Mr. Powell opposes the rezoning on the basis that insufficient evidence has been provided to confirm firm servicing. This has been a matter that I've been working on with Mr. Henderson for Cardrona Cattle Co, as bespoke servicing options are required given there are no council services in this location. While I'm happy to clarify the consenting requirements around future servicing, which I'd expect to be attainable, I do not have any further information from Mr. Henderson on this. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gibbons.
Were you going to take us through the
changes?
Oh,
the
yes, perhaps that might be, yes, that might be a good option. Yeah, thank you.
So this document essentially cherry picks the changes, so it should be read in the context of Mr. Place's rebuttal evidence for completeness. But if I work through it, I have suggested a new paragraph to add to the zone purpose, and the intent of that is to make it very clear that the zone is located near the council landfill, and to make it clear to a reader that there could be conflict there, and directs to the policy that I've placed in here for prohibition of certain activities. The new policy that I've, in my second point there, this links again to the landfill, which seeks to prohibit the establishment of residential, visitor accommodation, commercial recreation and community activities within the buffer of the landfill. This policy, in my view, is quite important because it's the only mechanism on the table, I guess is the best way of putting it, to actually achieve a prohibited status for incompatible activities within that landfill buffer. It's not in the plan at present. This is the only option that's been that's on the table, essentially.
And the buffer covers the whole site?
The buffer covers part of the site, so...
Where's it defined?
Where's the buffer defined?
Yes.
It's defined on the planning map in terms of an area, and then designation 76 in the text refers to a buffer zone as being incorporated within the designation, but there are no conditions.
Like I'm thinking just as a drafting issue, is that what this policy should refer to?
Oh, apologies, sorry, in the policy sense. Yes, correct. It should refer to the buffer of the landfill as shown on the structure plan for Victoria Flats.
Designation 76 on the planning maps is just an outline of the overall designation.
Yes.
But it doesn't say where the buffer area is.
Yeah, it's implied through the legal descriptions at the start of the designation.
So it's in the text that relates to that designation.
Yes, correct. But there's
rather than on the planning map.
Well, it is shown on the planning map.
It's within the designated area.
Correct.
But more as more particularly
table.
Defined by the text.
Yes.
Yeah, in the designation table. And is that in the ODP at the moment?
It's in the PDP.
It's been rolled out. They've been rolled out.
Yes.
Designations were in stage one.
Oh, thank you.
So it is in the table under designation 76. It's got the legal description. It distinguishes between the landfill and the buffer.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I understand you got provided a copy of Mr. Milne's updated information last night.
Yep.
Sheet 4 of that document has the structure plan, then overlaying on top of the structure plan.
Yeah,
so that's probably the best demarcation, I think, of showing the structure plan versus the designation.
Shows the designation.
So it's the blue dotted line.
Yes, correct.
The working assumption is that the buffer land is within the blue dotted line to the extent the CCCL land.
Yes, correct. So if I can take you through that plan, if I start from the top of the page, you can see the demarcations 1 and 2, which are along Victoria Flats Road.
Mm-hmm.
That's CCCL land within the buffer. And also, when you wind around Victoria Flats Road, you'll see another Area 2 and then part of Area 3 where the blue hash overlays. That's the other areas of the land. So essentially three discrete pockets.
And just to clarify, in the policy recreation, the word recreation is repeated deliberately?
Yeah, so commercial recreation and recreation. Objective 18A.2.3 is an existing objective that Mr. Place has put forward. I have sort of struck out the word pleasant.
Have you got the scope for that? Mm-hmm. Considering that it covers the whole zone?
Yeah, I'd need... I do think there is scope given that the submission did seek to recognise the landfill as part of the zone and the buffer within the landfill. This objective tries to achieve the zone as being a pleasant, healthy and safe place to work and visit. I don't know many industrial zones that I'd deem pleasant.
No, what I'm saying is this applies to not just to this zone, it applies to every other DIS zone in the district.
Might not be, the scope might be an issue, but it's nothing turns on that.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, because we've got that.
And then I suggest a new policy, 18A235, which recognise the activities located within the buffer of the landfill will potentially be subject to a lower level of amenity from lawful operations of the landfill in relation to noise, odour or dust.
What's the course of action that a policy requiring recognition involves? It's like the so what category.
Well, I put it in the same category as the term pleasant, actually. I think it's a it's an awareness. It's an awareness policy, I think.
Yeah. So who's recognising it and in what context?
I can answer that one from a legal perspective. Yeah. Policies are either implemented by zoning, by zones and rules that apply in the zones, or will apply on a case-by-case basis in a consent context. And this policy is implemented by the rules that recognise the sensitivity of some activities within the buffer in the sense that there are some prohibitions. So the prohibition, the rules prohibiting certain activity has got a policy framework. And so in that sense, there is recognition through the implementation of those rules. But it might also apply on in a consenting context where you have to have regard to objects and policies, and it just and recognise as a bring that matter to account, acknowledge it. It's a relevant matter to be considered.
Thank you.
So in terms of the rules, I'll try and move over these a bit quicker. The first one is the external appearance of buildings at Victoria Flats. And this was a very similar rule to the rural industrial zone in Chapter 21 of the plan, which relates to the external appearance that I understand Mr. Milne wanted to include within the provisions.
Is this an activity rule? You know how the rules have the activities tables and then the standards tables?
It's probably more appropriate as a standard.
Up to you?
Rather than an activity.
But I wouldn't have thought external appearance is an activity. I mean, in the general industrial zone, buildings are RD.
Yes.
So is this like an additional...
Yes, I think it's probably more appropriately placed as a standard on reflection, because it is designed to sit beside the building RD activity. Rather than being an activity itself.
Then isn't it an additional restriction of discretion that applies to new buildings within the Victoria Flats general industrial zone?
Sorry, sir.
If there's already acceptance of a restricted discretionary status for the building, then isn't its appearance a matter of discretion to be considered for that consent for a new building rather than a separate consent as if external appearance is something separate to the building?
Yeah, because are you actually are you actually asking for buildings at Victoria Flats to not all be RD?
No, no,
or only be RD if they're not painted brown, green, or grey.
Yeah,
what are you asking for here?
The confusion here is not having the rule within the greater plan.
No, that's a much bigger confusion than that. What are you actually asking for here with this standard?
So this is a standard that relates to the external appearance of buildings within.
But they're already RD.
But the standard is specific to the Victoria Flats zone. So all buildings within the general industrial zone are RD and do have matters of external appearance. This is another layer specific to the Victoria Flats general industrial zone. And this was something that Mr. Milne was quite firm on in terms of having some additional level of control on external appearance.
So what if the RD for buildings said it was to be painted beige or something?
That would impact the buildings in the entire zone, whereas this here only impacts buildings within the Victoria Flats. That's the distinction.
Okay, so this is an additional standard.
Yes, correct.
As a general question, and forgive me for starting to ask questions rather than waiting until you've finished, but as a structural assumption, is it intended that all of the rules that normally apply within the zone would apply unless specific rules you've added overrides them or sets them aside?
Correct. These provisions should be inserted into the final set.
Yep.
So where something is struck out or underlined, that's the only change.
So forgive me for jumping ahead, but I just want to make sure I understand it. So what we've just discussed, we're talking about the external appearance of any building within the Victoria Flats.
Correct.
Then if you skip ahead to your building height control.
Yes.
You've got height limits for areas 1, 2 and 3. Someone proposed a building outside of areas 1, 2 or 3. Does that then default to the underlying zone height limit?
The only areas of the zone are areas 1, 2 and 3.
What about those landscape areas?
Looking at Mr. Milne's plan, they still haven't underlined them.
So it's 100% of the GIS to be in one of the areas or other.
Sorry, say that again.
It's 100% of the GIS zone proposed to be in one area or another.
Yes, correct. I think that could probably be better shown on the structure plan.
There's a material distinction between the two areas of the area
gaps.
Of 1 and 2 at the north, then there's nothing to the area at the south.
Yeah, I might need to raise that with Mr. Milne because that was the intent.
Okay.
If
Mr. Milne's not writing the rules, you are.
Yeah, they're based off the structure plan. If, to avoid any doubt on this, there could be an additional point added to 18A56A that relates to all other areas because it's certainly not the intent to have buildings in those areas.
Thanks for just helping me understand that approach generally. As I said, I didn't mean to take you away from you working through them one by one.
On page 2, you'll see I've changed the activity statuses. That reflects the original submission from the Carter Owner Cattle Co. I understand there's been quite a lot of discussion on that. I've proposed a new 18A419, which has the prohibited statuses, and that's purely on the land within the buffer zone to give effect to those policies.
So what would happen to an office, retail or commercial activity anywhere would just become non-compliant activity?
Correct.
And does your submission cover that again over all GA zones?
Yes, it does. Okay. The original submission was actually seeking greater leniencies than what's been proposed now.
Across all the district? I mean, you're not the only people that have asked for that, but for your submission, does it cover, has it got a section in your submission that relates to beyond the site?
And just to clarify your question, you are relating to the changes of made from the prohibited to non-compliant,
yes,
as opposed to the new
rule.
My understanding of that submission was that it did relate to the provisions as a whole, rather than the provisions just for the Victoria flats. But I will clarify that,
okay.
just to make sure I'm telling you the right thing then.
Have you given us evidence on that? Have you given us any evidence on that matter?
On the change from the prohibited to non-compliant?
Yeah, across the district.
Not on a district scale, no.
Here's your submission.
Well, you can tell us later.
Just on scope while you're going there. I mean, the 12 metres, I recall reading your submission, and I think you asked for 10. I'm not sure there's a scope to go to 12. I know that through legal submissions, talking about these other consequential law. Can you just check that too? Because my memory, and it was a couple of weeks ago, and I read it, it asked for 10 and not 12.
You know, I think you're correct. It's a 10 metres.
What's that called? Height.
Height.
Yeah, we were just turning to the minimum boundary setbacks, there's an addition there at 18A53, which relates to a 40-metre setback, again, site-specific to Victoria Flats, from the State Highway 6, which is also shot on the structure plan as well. The building coverage rule, that hasn't been altered in terms of the general rule for the zone. However, there has been specific coverages amended specific to the Victoria Flats, which is Area 1, 2 and 3. This probably clarifies Commissioner Munro's queries earlier on, where Area 1 is a much lower coverage of 25, then moving up to 50, then maximum of 80. And Mr. Mill will be able to discuss how he arrived at those percentages.
And that's a coverage over the area of Area 1, or over the whole of Area 1?
Yes,
or each area of Area 1?
Yes, correct.
As opposed to each site?
I think inadvertently it relates to site when you get to a point of subdivision. So as a standalone allotment as it stands at the moment, it would be applied as 25% off that existing allotment.
So once it's subdivided, it would apply to each site?
Correct.
Yeah, that's what the definition of building coverage is.
Yes. And 18A56A, which relates to the height. If there is a scope issue there, the amendment needs to be made to remove the reference to the 12-metre towers. And in regard to glare, there's been one addition there as one of the matters of discretion specific to the Victoria Flat Zone, which relates to the prominence of a lot. right end, effectively from State Highway 6. A new standard has been introduced for setback plantings, and this reflects back to the structure plan itself, and Mr. Milnes provided the detail for this in terms of the planting species, the minimum heights to be achieved with the planting, and also the coverages of the area with matters of discretion there. The intent of that is to ensure that that is planted as part of the actual precursor development of the site, and that's reflected in the structure plan rule 27.7.12. So there is certainty in behind that. And just on the subdivision development chapter 27, there's a new policy there which is very similar to the other industrial zone structure plan policies, which basically relates to landscaping and roading layout. That would be a precursor information that would be provided as part of the initial subdivision to basically set the tone for the remainder of the development. The one change that we haven't worked on with our final text is the roundabout condition and the threshold that Mr. Edwards spoke to earlier on. My intent on that was to have that again as part of the structure plan requirement, that details be provided as part of the staging of the development, so there's a clear trigger point as to when those any upgrades would be put in place. I just needed some time just to clarify that and get the wording right with Mr. Edwards.
Can you talk, I mean, if it's the right time, can you talk us through that? Because the questions that certainly Commissioner Dawson and I are asking you is how it would actually work. I understand conceptually that at day one there's the right turning bay in 40%. Is it any 40% or is it specifically parts of area 1, 2 and 3 that could happen? And then, subject to the structure plan and then the subdivision, is it said, subdivision allowed, is it the one person who's bought a site then applies as an RDA, are they, and triggers the RDA consent, and NZTA gets involved, and it's then, are they required to provide the roundabout, or is there some mechanism where it will be the remaining 60% somehow is held together, and the application comes from that 60% in crude terms? So, I mean, I just want to talk us through that now.
For my planning sins, I'm dealing with three similar situations on State Highway 6 at the moment, from Cromwell to Gibson, in terms of three processes which will involve trigger points. So it's been quite topical in terms of how we reach those, and two of those processes are involved with NZTA. The one example in Cromwell, which from a structural perspective I think would work quite well, has a trigger point of number subdivided lots. So if that was reflected in this rezoning for industrial, I think that would be quite a clear mechanic. You'd have to relate that that those number of lots ideally back to the 40% threshold that Mr. Edwards has referred to. I don't know how many lots that would be off the top of my head, but I think in terms of the mechanics, I think that would be the most straightforward way. I do think having a structure plan requirement that requires plans to be provided prior to development that specifies where this 40% threshold is in terms of the land mass and any other constraints that need to be put in place. So I think that would be quite useful, and that should hopefully go some way of clarifying to any potential future purchaser who what obligations there are in terms of constructing that roundabout. My understanding with roundabouts is that it's a user pays. So if the Cardrona Cattle Co are proposing that, they are the entity that deals with the NZTA and comes to the arrangement on the funding, and I'd expect that to be a similar situation here.
I mean, as I understood, Mr. Edwards, it's not just a trigger on the roundabout, it's a trigger on shot of a bridge and shot of the functioning of the network. the two things. I mean, he talked about a restrictive discretionary activity for development that would trigger a review of both the intersection and the capacity of the state highway down at the Shotover end.
Yeah, I think
that we didn't have park and ride. As far as I could see, it was totally reliant on a whole lot of as yet unimplemented public facilities, such as public transport, park and ride, that are going to reduce the current usage of that highway to a point where it could accommodate the additional traffic from this development into the network without going beyond the capacity that it's virtually already at.
So hence having a trigger point to basically allow that assessment to be undertaken.
Yes. And then decline the development. If nothing to do with the roundabout, but if there was no capacity, if we didn't have park and ride or public transport that was accommodating everybody without... That's how I understood what he was saying.
Yes, I agree with that in principle. It's and I think he actually made the point of having NZTA as a specified affected party, and that's in current rules. That's an approach that's been taken in the PDP.
But it's the rules that needs to be there, not just the roundabout rule.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Are you working on that too?
Yes, I am.
And then what about the precondition for the right turning back?
I think that would be within the subdivision provision itself, and that's a precursor to development, and that's something else I need to add into the mix.
Now, thank you, Mr. Giddens. Commissioners, I've just observed that we're an hour and a half over time for this, but so I think you'd choose your questions carefully.
Just a suggestion, we've got a bit of time with Mr. Milne this afternoon, and whether Mr. Giddens was going to come back then.
That might be a better option. Is that a viable option from your point of view?
I need to do a daycare pickup at 4 o'clock, but let me see if I can sort some logistics out, and because it's obviously more convenient if I can, so I'll try and make that change.
I've only got one question.
Well, I'd say let's just see how we go. What's that? Yes, Wayfarer. Hey, all right. We'll go for 10 minutes, and I'll call time on the basis that we'll need to come back to Mr. Giddens in conjunction with Mr. Mill. Since you volunteered, Commissioner, you have the first question.
I could do this. My question relates to policy 4.2.1.4. Specifically, clause A.
Sorry.
Let me know when you've found that.
4.2.1.4.
Correct. Stop it.
Yes.
Righto. So in my mind, I'm trying to get my head around this mismatch that's been put to us around what the council's proposed for its urban growth boundary versus what might be appropriate to accommodate that longer-term need. And what I found in Clause A was this concept of over the planning period. And so the question is whether the planning period that the council has prepared a growth boundary in accordance with relates at all to what you think long-term is.
Yeah.
So do we know what the planning period is?
I've got two answers. One, that clause refers to the housing densities as opposed to the business, but...
Well, no, it just says ensure urban growth boundaries encompass a sufficient area consistent with, and it talks about assuming a mix of housing densities, but it doesn't limit itself to that, does it?
I'll answer your specific question. The planning period is difficult because we're in a rolling review.
Is it 10 years? The life of a plan between reviews?
Face value, the life of the plan, I'd say is usually looked at as 10 years, but we haven't got an operative plan. When does that 10 years start? And that's the point I'm making about the rolling review. We've been in this process since 2015. So is the 10 years from 2015, or is it from when we get an operative plan?
So let's take your first suggestion that Clause A might only relate to housing, and that then leaves us with Clause D, which relates to industrial uses. Yeah.
Yes.
And so we might have a situation, and I'm asking you, where the boundary is time-bound as it relates to housing, but not time-bound as it relates to industrial uses.
You're Which? Looking at an old version
is
of that.
This is,
I'm
I thought
afraid.
This was the,
no,
the consolidated
it's
version.
No, gone through a consent order.
I think I think I might have a different version as
well.
Well,
you have yes, because the planning period is no longer there. It's a medium term now. So
it's medium term. Well, that's a clearer answer to the long term. But the question of whether it relates to housing densities and falls is still a live one. Thank you.
Yep. I do think that there's a more clearer direction to make the need for the provision for the location and efficient operation of the infrastructure, commercial and industrial uses.
And do you think that might not be limited to the medium-term concept that's described in Clause A?
No, I don't think it does. I think it's now.
Okay, well, that was my question. Thanks.
Yep.
Thank you for that.
That's all right.
Commissioner Dawson?
It's not an easy thing to can I bring you, keep you on, have you got the consent order for
Chapter
4?
Yeah, I just want to make sure
four?
I'm working the right yes, I do. This was at the back of Mr. It's a draft consent order.
Luke Place's rebuttal has a draft consent order. That's the best we can do for the draft consent order. 4212. So if we assume, or if it's possible, that this is urban development, this says focus urban development primarily on land with in and adjacent to the existing larger urban areas, and to a lesser extent within and adjacent to smaller urban areas, towns and rural settlements. So which at first blush doesn't appear to include Victoria Flats. How do you fit an urban development for industrial purposes at Victoria Flat into that policy?
I think the addition of the word primarily.
Well, primarily relates to adjacent to existing larger urban areas, and
to a lesser extent. It doesn't read to me to be an absolute policy in terms of saying this is what must happen. I do think with an urban zone as well. It comes back to one of my earlier responses that. If you're focusing urban development on land, so I'm ignoring the word primarily there, within adjacent to large and existing larger urban areas, I wouldn't know where those areas in the Wakatipu would be.
So do you not think, say, I mean, you were pointing us out before, Coneburn and the area adjacent to Coneburn as a possible alternative, is that not adjacent to an existing larger urban area?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so we've got that's primarily, and then to a lesser extent within and adjacent to smaller urban areas, towns and rural settlements. So are you saying that Victoria Flats is one of those, a smaller urban area, town or rural settlement, or that there's flexibility to say, and beyond that, sometimes out in the rural area?
I think that the policy is I think I said before, it's not an absolute requirement. It's very directive.
It's quite directive, isn't
it? It's directive, but I wouldn't go as far as saying absolute.
So you're saying that could be read as allowing development beyond any of the areas mentioned in that policy?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so then let's look at the next one. 4213, ensure that urban development is contained within the defined urban growth boundaries.
Mm.
All right, so it's not at the moment, but you're saying it could follow.
Yes.
And that aside from urban development within existing towns and rural settlements, urban development is avoided outside of those boundaries. So you're saying that this area could be developed for urban development even though it's not within an existing town or rural settlement, or even adjacent to it, as long as the urban development boundary is put around it afterwards.
I would say that, but I just actually wanted to just double check the definition. Have a moment there. What of interest is what is a rural settlement?
I don't think it's defined.
No, it's not defined, and I firmly think Gibston is a rural settlement.
Gibston. And you say that includes the Victoria Flats area?
I think so. In terms of what a settlement is, if you look at, I'm very familiar with Gibston, in terms of what facilities are there and zoned, because there is going to be a commercial area within the resort zone. I'm very firm that would be a rural settlement. It's unfortunate it's not defined.
Plan says that specifically that resorts are not part of, are not urban development, so shouldn't we ignore that? Ignore the resort for this purpose?
My comment about the resort was about the facilities within it. There is a commercial area within that resort, so putting the definition to one side, it will be a facility that's used as part of that settlement. It is a public facility, I should say, too.
Okay. Then you get to 4214, which starts by talking about sufficient feasible development capacity and urban development opportunities, which, if we assume that this is urban development, is what this opportunity is providing. And then it's got a list of matters that it's got to be consistent with. The first one you discussed a minute ago is about providing for demand, but there are other ones there, such as a compact and efficient urban form, or avoiding sporadic urban development in rural areas, and consistent with a future development strategy that's prepared in accordance with the National Policy Statement. So how do you say this location fits with a compact and efficient urban form, which is also mentioned in the Chapter 3 policies about urban development, avoiding sporadic urban development in rural areas, the Chapter 3 ones talk about urban development builds on historical urban settlement patterns.
The only conflict I really see in 4.2.1.4 is the future development strategy for the district that is prepared in accordance with an NPS on urban development capacity, which is outdated now anyway, because there is no urban development capacity NPS. So I'm not sure where that would arrive at with the court.
But there still will be a future development strategy under the new NPS, won't there?
Yes, so I'd have to make the assumption that the court would be approving that addition to the provision, because when I look through the rest of those points there, I don't see great conflict, but with H is probably, and by virtue of timing, I think that's that would be the only conflicting clause I could see.
Commissioner, I think I've got to call time.
Okay.
Mr. Givens, I am hopeful that although we have scheduled the thick end of 2 hours for the Arthurs Point Protection Society this afternoon, we will not need anything like that, and we will make up some of that time. When could you attend?
Sooner the better, basically.
Sooner the better.
Yeah.
Well, if you were to be here at, I don't know how flexible Mr. Milne is, and when we could bring him in.
Not
but
before
What's that?
He was unavailable until 2. So after 2, he had another hearing.
Well, we'll start you as soon as we've finished the Arthurs Point Protection Society. And as I say, I'm hopeful that that will certainly be well before 3:40, which is when Mr. Milne was scheduled to come in. I was thinking more like 2:30-ish.
Okay.
Like I think that discussion is going to take less than half an hour.
Thank you. That's fine.
So we need to confirm childcare.
You'll just need to confirm the childcare.
Understand.
It may take 5 minutes or so.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as I say, we'll get to the end of Arthur's Point, and then we'll grab whoever we can find at that point.
Can we take 5 minutes now to confirm whether that's going to work for him, though? Is that all right, before you disappear? Because he might not be able to get childcare.
Wife is out of town, so...
Yes, I understand.
Yeah.
Joking, your domestic responsibility.
Yeah, so it's not one I can convince her off at the moment.
Yes. Well, if we go to Mr. Farrell for Wayfair, and you can talk to us after we finish with that.
Thank you.
So delete Wayfair.
Because we've taken too long, and he's not available this afternoon either, I suppose. Well, he already has. Can you email him, please, and tell him that we will give him written questions if we have any? Oh, well, we just got some found time. But we... Yes.
Now.
You still have 5 minutes because we have Mr. Patterson.
Okay.
So please, if you could check and see what you can do, and we'll go from there. And we have, I think it's Mr. Patterson for Ballantyne Properties Limited. You have the floor.
My name's Robin Patterson, and to my left is Neil Matchett, who is the director of Ballantyne Properties Limited. Mostly I will rely on my submission as put in, but I intend to speak to why is my opinion that Ballantyne Properties Limited land should be zoned as business mixed use in terms of its location in Wanaka and its context in terms of surrounding land use and zoning, but then I'm available to answer questions. If you go to the last sheet of that handout that I've just given, it shows the Ballantyne Properties Limited land, which is a 2-hectare block that just runs along Ballantyne Road. It has to the north the substation. To the south, it has a hire equipped place and Ballantyne and McEwen's service station, and across Ballantyne Road, 60% of its frontage is industrial usage. So my suggestion here is that it's inappropriate to rezone this residential and a good interface between industrial and residential, which is to the east, which is zoned to for the east, is business mixed use. The reason for this is really that Ballantyne Road is becoming a major arterial route, which leads out of Wanaka to the airport and services Mount Barker, the three parks commercial industrial area, and runs from the Wanaka town centre to these places and to the airport and then on to Central Otago. Looking at the business mixed use zone, from stage two of the proposed district plan, the intention of this zone is to provide for complementary commercial, business, retail and residential uses that supplement the activities and services provided by town centres. And I do realise that higher density living opportunities close to employment and recreational activities are also enabled. So, I go on to this. This zone gives the maximum flexibility for a well-designed commercial business area close to both the town centre and the Three Parks retail centre. There is a need by council to ensure the supply of business commercial land enabled under their district plan, especially for high growth councils such as QLDC. My experience over the last 20 years leads me to consider that while Queenstown is the international tourist hub of the South Island, Wanaka is often the centre where New Zealanders prefer to live, to run their businesses from, or to retire. This has become more evident as the ability to work remotely has become easier, use of internet, etc., but may be exacerbated by the huge number of Kiwis returning since the COVID pandemic has hit. Now, of course, last night the COVID pandemic has reared its ugly head again, but this would suggest that Wanaka needs to be prepared for accelerated growth over the next decade or so, and I'm not sure that this is really appreciated by the Business Development Capacity Assessment 2017, which was commissioned by QLEC. If Wanaka was going to have an increased need for business commercial use, could the same argument apply to industrial land, which some of this property was notified as? The increase in growth in Wanaka's population is likely to be more of what is here now, retired or semi-retired people, people here for lifestyle reasons rather than those that need a full-time job. The cost of buying a house in and around Wanaka means that Wanaka doesn't have a pool of workers who would be available for industrial-type manufacturing jobs. The needs of existing and future Wanaka are more likely to be trade-related suppliers and retailers of specialty services, i.e. bakeries, electrical, plumbing, wholesaler, trade stores, hardware suppliers and gyms. If there was a need for more business land because of the upcoming growth of Wanaka, then that same argument must apply to residential land. So why am I suggesting that Ballantyne Properties Limited should go to business mixed use rather than residential? The main reason is that we should be establishing neighbourhoods where retail, business, schools, recreation and medical facilities are in the same general location, so we can facilitate traffic coordination for all of these things. It's poor urban design if someone needs to go to one part of town to meet a lawyer, another part to go to the supermarket, another part to buy some paint to paint a wall. This is whether you go by car, bus or electric bike. And so what I'm suggesting is that at some time in the future, the growth of Wanaka is going to need bus services, etc. And this area of Ballantyne Properties land is not far from the medical centres, not far from the Three Parks commercial centre, and not far from the existing industrial area. I'm now available for questions.
Thank you. Mr. Patterson, wanted to ask you and Mr. Matchett first a question about the substation. The Aurora team have made a submission seeking a setback effectively on Ballantyne Properties land around their substation. Four sides of the substation, and you've got two of them, and they've asked for 20 metres. What's your view of that?
in the follow-up, in the further submissions which Mr. Mitchett lodged, he said, I oppose the building restriction 20 metres from the cadastral boundary of the substation. This area has been zoned low-density residential under plan change 4, and any concerns relating to proximity to the substation were more correctly dealt with at that stage. I think it's kind of cheeky of Aurora to try and sterilise my client's land if they needed a 20-metre buffer to protect themselves from reverse sensitivity issues or anything else. They should buy it.
You'll be comforted to know that I put that question almost exactly in those words to them. Mr. Munro.
No, thank you.
Mr. McLeod.
I think that is perfectly clear. Thank you very much. It's very clear to me what you're asking too. Thank you.
Mr. Hill. Mr. Dawson.
Just a quick question. The southern end of your site, which I think might be McEwen. I think that Mr. Roberts in his rebuttal has suggested zoning that to a new zone called Three Parks Business. Am I right? Have you caught up on that?
No, I haven't.
Does that suit you?
And yes, I think the existing land use, the land use with the higher quit place and the service station, is there and exists.
Mm.
And so, under the what was notified, they're showing our the land as business use, or no, as general industrial. And the preference would be, really, Mr. Matchett wants to build something he can be proud of here. And I'm not sure that residential would be the right thing, because you're going to have to put a 2-metre fence all the way along Ballantyne Road, and I don't think that's appropriate. And you have to, but also the preference would be not to do industrial land. There seems to be land zoned sufficient for industrial use within Wanaka. And the problem in Wanaka is that people can't afford to come and live here and work in a factory. To buy a house here costs $1 million. Any house, really. The type of people that live in a place like Wanaka are those that can afford to live here. Now, I'm treading on thin ice making such statements, but that's my belief. So we would like to develop this land in something that we can be proud of, not something that just fits into the zoning.
Well, thank you.
Commissioner Smith.
Thank you. A couple of questions. One is around the Three Parks structure plan, and the previous Three Parks special zone had a road opposite Gordon Road as a secondary road, I think, within the structure plan. But in the current proposal, that road no longer exists because it's a secondary road, not a primary road. They only picked up the primary ones. What's your view on a road that runs through the site opposite Gordon Road and linking into Three Parks as a part of the network?
And it comes down to specific design, but at this stage our thoughts, if this land remained residential, would be that we wouldn't complete it. Now, that we would create a residential usage that goes in a crescent time type system along the middle of our land. But that's not to say that we wouldn't do exactly what Mr. Dippy has done on Umber Street. We would take it so far up and make it available to him if he wanted to carry on and build the road through Three Parks.
I suppose you made the point about integrated living around, you know, living close to being able to get to school and being able to go to, you know, you can imagine that Alpine Estates and the development on Bright Sky and all that sort of and in fact Gordon Road itself, that people will want to be able to travel to the school and the rec centre and the in an effective way, and equally, you know, it's not unreasonable that Umber Street and other street would connect up to whatever. I suppose the point is that this can't be viewed in isolation. It has to be viewed in the context of the things around it, and how do we make that best work? And is it best to try and reinstate that road into the structure plan to make that work?
And I do understand Gordon Road as exists now, on the eastern end of Gordon Road, the bit that you can see on that aerial photograph, is not necessarily appropriate for an arterial route. Now I know that's what has started from the medical centre, and I think it will happen, even though my opinion is not necessarily appropriate. And so, having gone through to Ballantyne Road, I think probably there needs to be another connection through this land to Three Parks.
Okay.
It doesn't necessarily need to be on Gordon Road, but a connection through.
Okay, yep. Thank you. And, I mean, it's interesting you make that comment about Gordon Road on record saying that the integrated plan meeting of that entire block has not been well thought about, and I suppose trying to avoid that problem in the future. One other quick question is that this land was previously subject to a proposal for Countdown, is that right? Is that...
Not that I'm aware of, but that's quite possible.
That's correct.
That's correct. It is. A Countdown supermarket was proposed on this site.
Yes.
Is that still... Do you still aspire to do that, or is there something
I've
else?
Had no contact with Countdown. That's all walked away from it. Yeah.
Okay. So your interest in this, it's not about a specific proposal. It's more about, you know, is it about enabling an economic outcome?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
That's all.
You good? Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Giddens, how's your domestic arrangements?
Not great, sir.
Well, you better sit down then.
So would you like to hear from me?
Yes.
Then? Okay.
We'll go as long as we need to go.
Apologies.
I understand.
Thank you. Only has two names on the list, my own and my wife, Susan Christchurch.
And she's not coming back. How inconsiderate.
Not to 8 o'clock.
Three.
Commissioner Dawson, I interrupted you. You were in a full flow.
Oh, well, sort of no longer am. I think Mr. Giddens had said that there was a potential for conflict with the policy relating to urban development being consistent with a future development strategy. Whereas you didn't think there were any other conflicts with that policy, so I won't pursue that any further. But
if I may, Commissioner, I just did have a little bit further thought on that, just in the moments there, I had a break. And just looking at I'm still a bit of paperwork here. Looking at the NPS for urban development, well, to go back a step, if urban growth boundaries couldn't be changed until a future development strategy was prepared, after that, then you're going to be dealing with this in the next plan review. And then when you look back at the NPS for urban development from Policy 2, which says Tier 1, 2 and 3 local authorities at all times provide at least sufficient development capacity to meet expected demand for housing and for businesses, land, over the short term, medium term and long term, I think there's a potential conflict there. And then when you go back to Policy 1, I believe that's the policy that refers to planning decisions contribute to well-functioning urban environments, what are urban environments that as a minimum, and then that refers back to the have or enable a variety of sites that are suitable for different business sectors in terms of location and site size. And I think the difficulty I have is that policy I wasn't aware of when I did my evidence, because I wasn't aware that there was a draft consent order, it may not have been put through at that time.
I'll be surprised if the court wouldn't look at that and ask for some further work to be done from the parties in regard to the new policy framework and the MPS. So I just struggle a little bit with that.
Do you think that the National Policy Statement is pushing councils to not just wait for each review, but to keep their plans updated as they do future development strategies, which may well be by plan changes if they haven't achieved the milestones required?
I see the point. I think my experience with reviews, they're not short processes in any way, so you still could be talking 2 to 5 years for
no
a
kidding.
Review.
It doesn't entirely rely on reviews. It's because of the timeframes in that MPS that's pushing councils to do more regular updates to their plans and to keep them up to date through...
Oh, as a fluid process.
As an ongoing process.
Yes, I agree.
And as I understand it, there is a future development strategy being worked at on, or we've been told there's a future development strategy being worked on at the moment. Mm. And that would allow, I mean, the evidence from Mrs. Hampson and Mr. Place is that would allow options to be considered for where the long-term requirements for industrial land in Wakata area, in the Wakata ward are provided for, weighing up the sorts of matters that are contained in policy 4214, weighing up the sort of impacts that Ms. Hampson's covered in hers in terms of the costs and benefits, the roading implications, the landscape implications, the servicing provisions. Because you say in your evidence, the difference between you and Ms. Hampson is she thinks wait for the SDS and you say no, do it now. So why, given the way this policy's heading
I think just on the first question you had there was what, I guess the difference between myself and Ms. Hampson, I'm not criticising her at all and her work, she's great at what she does. I think in terms of the approach I've taken is I've looked at what zones are available in terms of my evidence, and I've also looked at what activities are provided for within those various zones, and I think Ms. Hampson's done a very good job of actually putting some provisos next to certain zones. By saying, I think I mentioned before, the airport industrial zone, said, well, this is land that's been put into the mix to say, hey, there is an extra 14 hectares of capacity here. However, it's unlikely that capacity is going to be realised. And then I think she's done the same for the Remarkables Park zone. And if I use the Remarkables Park zone, where I think a difference between Ms. Hampson and myself is if you look at storage activities, for example, which is an industrial use, they're either non-compliant or prohibited. In that zone, whereas the general industrial zone permits them. So I don't think you can say here's a zone and it's ready to go and there's capacity without looking at the mechanics of those rules within those zones as well. And then I think it comes to Coburn. Coburn is the zone there that's been most recently zoned, and on the face of it there's capacity, but when you look at the MPS requirements and practical requirements of servicing, and there's a lot of precursors that need to be done to that zone before it can be, I use the term shovel ready.
But there are the same precursors to this zone. I mean, we're already starting to talk about precursors in relation to roading.
Yep.
You've got precursors relating to landscape. You haven't provided us with any information about the servicing other than that you think it can be done. But we have council evidence saying, no, it's of a scale that we're going to have to start looking at connecting it into some sort of reticulated system somehow or other.
Yeah, the council.
So, I mean, you can't really say that your zone, this zone, is any more shovel-ready than Coburn, can you?
No, I can't. I don't think I am saying that. What I'm saying is even Ms. Hampson's, I think, concluded that there was either 4 or 14 hectares of capacity at the moment that needs to be met, and that's as it stands now, as I understand. So that's not even short term; it's immediate term. So when you get to the short, immediate, and long terms, and look at her own projections that she's put forward, the fact that the Cardrona Cattle Company land isn't shovel ready and Coneburn's not shovel ready, my reading of her evidence is that there's still capacity to be needed. And I say that in terms of the Wakatipu.
My understanding of her conclusion is that in Wakatipu Basin there is sufficient for the short to medium term, but not for the long term. But are you saying that your greater examination of the constraints on the areas she's looked at mean that that's not even sufficient for now?
Correct.
Okay, so that goes a bit beyond. It's just not a matter of timing. It's like there's an urgency, you're saying.
And it goes back to one of my criticisms, and I think I might have just overviewed in my summary. I think when you look at how the capacity's been evaluated for existing industrial zones, I don't believe there's actually much that's actually going to be created from the tinkering. I think the way that the capacity is would be generated is by way of new zones or expansion of existing zones, and I just don't see that in the stage three proposal. I don't think there's enough there for Wakatipu.
But you don't think that there needs to be a greater weighing of options to provide that additional capacity?
Well, the problem you have in Queenstown, and I'll give you an example of Ladies Mile. Ladies Mile was put forward as part of stage one of the district plan review for alternative zonings. I think it was rural, lifestyle, residential type zonings. And that now is going to be subject to a master plan for more intensive urban development. But in the process, I think there's been three SHAs that have been turned down on those sites and development stalled. It's in Queenstown, it's very rare to see sites that are development worthy stay as a status quo. And I think I put it in my rebuttal, it may be I'm pretty firm on the belief and some of the instructions I've had in terms of consenting is that if this land is not rezoned, the next best use will be found for it. And that's a principle that I've seen applied throughout Queenstown. And as a land resource, and as a relatively, I think a very suitable site for non-residential activities near a landfill, I think this is a resource that if it's not secured in some form for industrial land use, it's going to be missed. It's going to be used for something else.
Okay. That's all from me.
What might that something else be? Because, we've heard evidence... Mm. Well, sorry... I'm aware that there have been other plans and, for this site, and obviously there's a rural visitor zone sort of concept as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we've also heard evidence that it's not necessarily, correct me if I'm wrong, that it wasn't necessarily that great for grapes as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, what are other alternative use that you're promoting? What's the risk if we don't zone it industrial? What's going to happen to it?
Well, there's an active rural visitor zone request on there. There was the SHA proposal, which had 900 house sites for the Gibson Valley site. There's already a consent and process for storage facility, and that's actually a very good example, because that is an activity that required a hectare of land. And there isn't a hectare of industrial land that enables storage activities within the Wakatipu. You have to go revert to a non-compliant consent in a rural zone to be able to achieve that.
I suppose what I'm getting at are the other things at this point in time fanciful in the RMA context? Because they've equally either been unsuccessful or not inactive.
Well, I wouldn't go as far as saying fanciful. My opinion, and I've been pretty firm on it in my evidence, is I believe that land is most appropriate for industrial, and I stand by that. I think it's that's the best land use for that, especially next to a landfill. The fact of the matter is, portion of its zone, Gibson character zone, that's fact, that's an operative zone in the PDP. So there are enabling activities associated with that, and as I say, I think in terms of a next best use, it could form some sort of residential. In my rebuttal, I think I refer to the clause 28 of the council's sales purchase agreement, and when you look at that, the council can't object and have to provide an affected person's approval. The council was the closest landowner to that land, so, and from a resource consenting process, that creates quite a lot of difficulties for the council. And a plan change process is different, and I think you can look at things a lot more holistically, but if you're applying for one-off or a number of resource consents on that land, and your only affected party essentially is the council, then the hurdles become much less.
Okay. All right, sorry to interrupt there. Did you have any...
No, I'm finished.
And I look, most of it's been covered, and I won't rehash, but I will just... The future development strategy, I mean, I'm certainly aware that, you know, the FDS for the purpose of the MPS is in play, you know, and could even become public by the end of this month or next month, you know, certainly in the next couple of months, you know, so it is well and truly in play. Is something, is a development of this nature and a strategic view, is it best being dealt with through the FDS?
No, I don't think so, and it comes back to one of my earlier responses. I think there's a process in play now for rezonings and looking at the general industrial zone, and I think that's the appropriate zone for the site. My experience with council processes, be it for better or worse, is that they can take a bit of time, and if you've got an FDS, that doesn't mean that zoning is going to be advanced. I think if you look at the MPS itself, it directs that would be an outcome, but there's no real timing in place for when that would happen, so I feel it'd be a missed opportunity.
Mr. McLeod?
Nothing, sir.
Mr. Hill?
Just a couple for me, and I won't labour the point too much. Just go back to those strategic provisions. Is it your view, is it the same as Ms. Stevens, that the urban growth boundary is not a strategic planning tool? And if not, what is it from a planning point of view?
Good question. It's not a strategic planning tool in the sense that it's reflected in the higher order of RPS. And I think that if it was, and I think I referred to the Christchurch example previously, it fixes lines in terms of then strategically those boundaries are very important. If you're on one side of the boundary, you have a much higher hurdle. And I think in this plan, while they are important in terms of guiding where urban development is located, my understanding of the strategic objectives and policies is that it's intended that they will be reviewed and they will and it will move.
So can I just continuing on with that, with the consent order provision, just drop down to that one about 422A objective, about the compact and integrated provision, and then it talks about in the policies allocating land within the urban growth boundaries into zones. This is page 8 of the draft consent order. It's really just continuing on the line that Commissioner Dawson and Mr. Munro were going to. But if we go to that objective 422A, which is about compact and integrated, well designed, and then there's policies. And it's more, I just want to get a general sense. How does a spot zone effectively be, is that compact and integrated? But also when you look at the policy 4222, allocate land within the urban growth into zones, and just the flavour of reading it, it reads like it was the whole approach to this chapter and the urban growth boundary was to be a strategic plan. And I accept it's not like Christchurch and it's not like Auckland in that sense. But it's hence how I think this is one of the issues we'll be grappling with. How does, say, Cadrona Cattle Company's, I'll call it a spot zone, because that's probably what it is, create compact and well-designed? Does that need to be looked at in the overall context of Wanaka? Or does it get looked at in terms of the spot
Wanaka
zone itself?
Yeah. Wanaka or Wakatipu?
Wakatipu,
sorry.
Yeah, I just commenting quickly on the isolated element of it being a spot zone. Arthur's Point's an example of another settlement that's got an urban boundary around it, isolated from the rest of the context. And can you just repeat your question?
So I'm just thinking, I mean, how does this proposal fit within compact and integrated?
I would view compact and integrated in the sense of what we're looking at in the area and in terms of the Wakatipu itself. I think if you go down to compact and integrated, you're going down to quite a fine scale. If you're looking at it in the sense of being near and close to urban other existing urban areas. And I think it comes back to one of my questions earlier on, is that if you did interpret that policy to direct that expansion should be near or next to urban existing urban areas, you run out of land. It's a limiting factor on the walk.
I understand that. But thank you. But just the other question I've got, were you involved in the land use consent application that's before the council?
Yes, I was.
So can you very quickly, what sort of scale, what's the activity? I understand it's storage. What sort of scale was it notified, and when are you expecting a decision?
It was 412 storage units over an area of about 9,800 square metres. So the site itself is part of the buffer zone in
the
here.
Buffer, right.
It's in, if I refer you to the structure plan, it is. It would be an area, it probably traverses area 1 and 2 of the structure plan adjoining Victoria Flats Road. So that required about 1.5 hectares of land, and one of the reasons, obviously, for that site location was because there is land there and of suitable size to provide for it. That was limited, notified to the council and scope, and oddly enough, Central Otago District Council as a co-leasee, I believe, of the landfill. And I believe just waiting on closing submissions, so it might be 3 weeks away,
yeah.
3 to 4
yeah,
weeks away from a decision.
Thank you. Any more for any more?
No.
I think that's it from us, Mr. Giddens. We're
thank
back
you.
To hear Mr. Milne.
Mr. Milne. Oh, I just wondered whether I could just make one very simple comment just
yes.
in relation to the this consent order version of the policy, the Chapter 4 policy, and in the context of the MPSUD. I understand the purpose behind the FDS, and every council, every Tier 1 and 2 council has to have one within the specified timeframes. Clause 3.17, you must have regard to the FDS when preparing or changing an RMA planning document, and you're strongly encouraged to use the relevant FDS to inform long-term plans, regional transport plans, etc. But I can't see, and so that's their intended purpose. But I can't see anything in here that supports the proposition that a plan shall not be changed unless there is in place an FDS, unless land is shown as being identified for urban development in that FDS. As there is in some, you know, that is the case in Waimakariri District Council. In the RPS it says no more land for rural residential development unless it's provided in a rural residential development strategy, which is also promulgated under the LGA. It sits outside of the RMA. So all I'm saying is that our evidence is that there isn't enough land to expand existing, you know, to provide for additional industrial land as an expansion to existing industrial business zones, and therefore this does create effectively a new zone, but it does consolidate existing development which is industrial in nature, and that's so in that sense it meets an aspect of that policy. But going back to the Coneburn example, and in theory the land outside of the UGB that's adjacent to that Coneburn land might be suitable, but there's been no assessment. It's purely hypothetical as to whether it's suitable or not. There have certainly been no submissions asking for opportunities to expand the existing zone, so I don't think you can proceed on the basis that land has been earmarked for an expansion of industrial zone within Wakatipu.
Thank you, Ms. Stephen. As I say,
I've given you the opportunity, along with other parties, to respond to Mr. Nolan's argument about on the plan by next Friday. We'll hear from Mr. Milne, in effect, to complete the Corona Cattle Company case this afternoon. I have one last question. You have alternative relief seeking rural visitor, but it appears very little, if no evidence, to support that. What is the status of that relief?
Tony's prepared landscape evidence. So that's
yeah. Well, yes, there was only some landscape evidence.
Yes, the Mr. Milne talks about it, identifies it on his plans.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
I would have to take instructions.
No, it's still the proposition is still active.
And that's the extent of the evidence that's been given in support of it, and that's as much as we can, as far as we can take it.
Okay, thank you. So we'll hear from Mr. Milne this afternoon, as soon as we can get to him. To those present, we need to stop for some lunch. We're running late, but we'll be as fast as we can. I think we'll start at 2:00.
Thank you.